Amplify from Device. It's our number one song for the second straight week.
That wraps it up for us. If you miss any part of the chart, you can get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com.
And you can always download the free iHeartRadio app to listen to us. And don't forget that we're on XM 242. That's right. I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we'll see you.
The Side Show is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
If you think that a kiss is on the lips, come on. You got it all wrong, man. And if you think that a dance was on the hips, oh well, then do the trip. If you think holding hands is all in the fingers, grab hold of the soul where the memory remains. And make sure to never do it with a singer, cause I'll tell everyone in the world what he was singing about the girl.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Jolene Jordan's face is about 3 inches from mine.
Last-minute damage control to do there.
Yeah, I don't know whether we
fix
it or not. Okay, we're good. Welcome to the broadcast. Thank you for joining us. This is the period of the week that WRIF has set aside for the last, I don't know, like 43 years.
Yeah.
That's getting on like half a century, isn't it? To let you, the listener, express your opinions about what's happening in our world, including
in
our city.
Our state, our country. And, you know, I just want to start out on kind of a sad note, but I never have really dedicated a show to anyone before, but we always kind of do just by talking about tragedy and tragic situations. But I'm dedicating this to a friend of mine named Sunshine, who was shot and killed over the weekend in California, trying to defend a young woman from a male perpetrator, and the man shot them and killed them both. He was 26, she was 18, and he was the most gentle soul you've ever met in your life. And I just want to say, you know, this is for Sunny, and I'm going to lay it straight out there. I am so tired of gun violence.
Yeah, and it seems like it's just increasing. I think I've frequently said, unless you really look at the news sites every day, you might not be quite aware of it. But it is extensive and it's growing. I mean, wasn't there a period, I think it was last week in Detroit, 26 people
yes.
were shot?
Yes. And not all killed, but shot.
Yeah, yeah. So it just keeps... It just keeps on going. This will freak everybody totally, but even though I own guns, that if somehow we could magically get them all up, get rid of them all.
There you go.
And then start parceling them out to the, you know, never mind. I take it all back. I take it all back.
No, you don't.
I take it all back.
No.
Here's why. Because for one thing, it's impossible to happen.
Right.
And that's the thing about people say, well, you're going to inconvenience law-abiding citizens if you have background checks at gun shows, even though you have to have them at you know, when you buy them. But, you know, all these people, as we always say, everybody's law-abiding citizen until they...
Until they're not.
Until they're not.
You know,
yeah.
And
so
this they got the suspect... You know, I don't know anything about the gun or anything like that at this point because it just happened, but we'll find out.
Well, here's what I think. Well, I got a story that has to do with what a lot of RIF listeners and a lot of RIF broadcasters, including me, do, which is probably what you all are going to find is the big story. Supposedly, the big story that's just, revving up the nation.
The nation?
The whole country.
Okay.
Scandal. Benghazi. Everybody knows where that is, right?
I thought you meant the TV show.
Oh, no.
Where she's doing the president?
Yeah. My wife has me. Yeah. And she's African-American and he's white. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. But no, the scandal's Benghazi, which is not a scandal. It's just, I would be willing to bet 80% of the people don't even know what's going on.
Like, they're like, who's Benghazi?
Yeah, yeah.
For real.
It's related to Al-Qaeda.
I'm a Dinjad.
Yeah, right. But in any event, there ought to be looks at any point in what constitutes U.S. policy. I mean, one of the things no one asks is, why in the world did we have a consulate in Benghazi, Libya?
Yeah.
I mean, where were the Chinese? Maybe they did. Maybe the Chinese have them as well. I mean, essentially, it was a CIA outpost, according to a man who was a... I mean, not that that in any way reduces the concern we have for the people that suffered at the hands of these... whatever they were, that killed them all, the Al-Qaeda people. Melvin Goodman, who is the director of National Security Project at the Center for International Policy, was an analyst at the CIA for 24 years. I just interviewed him about his book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, where he says this is what we expect back, this kind of blowback.
Sure.
He wrote a piece called The Real Benghazi Scandal. He said, when congressional Republicans complete manipulating the Benghazi tragedy, it will be time for the virtually silent Intelligence Committee from the Senate to take up three major issues that have been largely ignored. The committee must investigate the fact that the U.S. presence in Benghazi was an intelligence platform and only nominally a consulate. The whole thing was politicized by the White House and the State Department of CIA analysis of the events in Benghazi. So, you know, do bureaucrats tend to cover their ass when something goes wrong? Yeah.
Yes.
Is this a scandal of proportions consistent with the other?
Let's look at some other scandals throughout history.
Yeah, I don't think so.
And weigh that out. I don't think so at all.
Not at all. Were they shuffling around? I mean, I don't even understand it. What the idea that President Obama said 2 days later that it was a terrorist attack, or was it terrorism or terrorist or terror? I mean, I just don't get it. And the frauding of these Republicans who are just using it as another way to absolutely stall government completely.
They don't have a lot. Right now.
They don't. Well, they think they do, because then they have this... they have this so-called IRS scandal. And is it a scandal? Okay, I'll call it a scandal. And why, though, that it wasn't called a scandal when George Bush did it by the Republicans in Fox News? Well, we can only speculate.
Right.
Is there a pack of effing hypocrites?
Yes.
Yeah, because
being nice.
I was outraged, and people are saying, wait a minute, Bush. Oh, yeah, I remember him. Yeah, he was the guy that was before the current guy who was in there for absolute ever. I mean, that's what, you know, people feel. I mean, what the immediate, there is no history. Everything is you know, right now. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I said, if people that are listening that are, say, 22 years old, you know, full adult, participant in our society yeah. and all that, they were like, nine when Bush stole the first election.
Oh, yeah, I thought you were going to go back to 9/11. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, but here, this was in, where was it? Oh, an alternate, a good site, alternet.org. Considering the gravity of the allegations against the Obama IRS from the Treasury Department's Inspector General, congressional scrutiny is certainly warranted, says this article. However, there's just one problem. Most of the lawmakers and pundits today decrying the use of public resources against a White House's political opponents had little, if anything, to say about the equally troubling revelations about the Bush administration's deployment of public resources against its opponents. In fact, conservatives said so little back then that Fox News apparently doesn't even know or is pretending not to know that the Bush administration used the IRS in the same way the Obama administration allegedly did, which isn't really true. I mean, this is so complicated. There's a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United that allowed this essentially unending stream of money going into the political process. So even more so than ever, elections are just bought by the highest bidder.
Yeah.
The ones that were taking
no limits.
Yeah. The ones that were taking the most advantage of this were these Tea Party groups. So these people who had no idea what the regulations were or what the criterion were, anything like that, said, okay, here are the political groups. They all got Tea Party and Patriot and what have you. So there is, I would say it's misfeasance all along as opposed to malfeasance. I mean, who knows? I mean, maybe there was some Democrat that said, oh, okay, I'm going to really screw with these people because, but you remember, they weren't auditing them. They didn't do audits on them. These were people that were applying, essentially with a subterfuge, saying that they were a public service organization and only part of their activity was going to be political. In other words, you can do up to 49%. As it turns out. So they're scamming the system. They wanted to pay no taxes. So the idea that they were vetted, the idea that they were investigated, is not without some merit.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, by the way, got the tax-exempt status. And, you know, so. But there's more. There's even more incredible thing. The Bush cabal didn't use just the IRS for its political hackery. It mounted a full-scale government-wide assault on its enemies, marshaling a number of agencies in its smear efforts. Bush's use of the IRS was but one part of the larger assault. In 2005, Bush's IRS began what became an extensive two-year investigation into a Pasadena church after an orator dared to speak out against President Bush's Iraq war. Now, this they were trying to take away its church-exempt, tax-exempt status, which I don't think churches should have tax-exempt status at all. But if you agree with Bush and the Republicans, then you get it, and if you don't, then you can investigate it. That doesn't work. Not coincidentally, the Los Angeles Times report that the church targeted just so happened to be one of Southern California's largest and most liberal congregations. That IRS church audit came a year after it launched a near-identical attack on the NAACP after the Civil Rights Organization criticized various Bush administration policies. But they also used the Secret Service. Under the Republican president, that law enforcement agency was repeatedly deployed to physically block suspected anti-war activists from attending public presidential events. I mean, that's all just swept down the memory hole. But we remember that, right?
Well, I was there. Well, you were there. I was there. A couple of those inaugurations and different things, and they had us penned in these little...
Well, that's right. They devised these free speech zones.
That's such crap.
Yeah.
I mean, it was...
But this was where there was, like, Bush would have a public talk, and someone would have an anti-war T-shirt,
yeah.
and they would get slammed to the ground
yeah.
by the Secret Service and these goons from the Republican Party.
Yeah.
So the real scandal began with the Bush administration, and this is just a small reflection of it. CIA was also in on this. The FBI improperly investigated some left-leaning U.S. advocacy groups after September 11, citing cases in which agents put activists on terrorist watch lists, even though they were involved in nonviolent activity.
I don't know if we were on there, but I don't think you and I were on anything like that, but we know people who I'm sure were on there.
Yeah, yeah. So,
we run when the pepper spray happens, you know.
Fox News had a headline this week summarizing a Karl Rove interview blaring, "What if IRS under President Bush targeted liberal groups?" As if that it never actually happened, even though it most certainly did.
Well, you know how they were sending in, you know, undercover people to some of these anti-war meetings.
And also to advocate provocative actions and violent actions and try to entrap people.
Yeah. They did.
So you would say, well, why in the world, since there is a so-called liberal press, why weren't they all over the Republicans? You know, that is the problem with liberals. They're really frightened of right-wingers. There's something about the fascist mentality that comes out of the right wing that exudes, I don't know, maybe this, I don't want to get too psychoanalytical, this father figure. So they're actually frightened. And one of the things that'll happen, see, this was all generated. This whole Benghazi, this IRS, the AP thing is where they were subpoenaed the phone records of the Associated Press, a different thing. But the first two, these were all, I mean, Rush Limbaugh has not been so happy since he was doing OxyContin. I know, folks. I stole that from Bill Maher.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. I did. I can't. Probably seven people realize that, but I always have to be honest. There's very little liberal press, but the centrist press.
Very little.
Yeah. The centrist in here. There's no left wing press.
No, there is. There's one.
What?
Yours.
No, I mean, there's lots of little radical publications and all that. You know, there's Mother Jones and The Nation and all
great.
But I'm talking about, like, daily papers and like, NPR and what have you.
Yeah.
So that they, you know, like a dog on the bone. That's mm-hmm. what fascists are, man. They never give up.
You know,
it doesn't matter what kind of scandals they're involved in or what kind of corruption, personal and political, they're exposed to being involved in. They just keep on it. It's like it never misses a single beat.
Well, on the other side, you know what? You and I keep on it too.
Yeah, we do. but here's the deal.
Their part is so evil.
But they started, what Fox News did was to start saying, why won't the liberal press cover this emerging scandal? So these liberals go, oh, well, they're going to think we're partisan, that we're supporting the liberals.
So we better get out there.
So we better ramp up the right-wing talking points. And so now they're talking about impeachment, and they're talking, you know, this is a scandal of Watergate proportion.
It just is not. People are out of their mind.
Do you realize there was a scandal under the Reagan administration in which that Reagan had the United States secretly trading with Iran?
Yeah.
And in order to arm these fascist death squads in Central America that Congress had specifically said could no longer be funded.
Some people think he was the greatest president ever. He was so presidential.
That, you know, the fact I was talking to these, you know, I play handball on the east side and the west side. I hope these east side guys aren't listening. It seems like everybody on the east side are these Republicans. I don't get it.
For real?
Yeah. And they're saying, and they were like in a froth, you know, Obama, you know, God, he's the worst scandal in it. I said, well, Wasn't there a scandal or so under Bush? I'd said it like this. And they said, what? Why? Which one? What? What? And I go, God, there's got to be one.
God.
How about the Iraq War? And they went, well, he thought they had weapons of mass destruction.
No, he lied. He lied.
And I said, how come I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I said, you know, you've known me for a little while, guys. You know, I'm smarter than that guy, right?
Right.
So
yeah,
that may
be real.
That may be, you know, something. But there was also, and these things.
I hope you kick their ass in handball.
Yeah, this is, it's mixed. But hey, the left wing handball players ultimately are better than the right wing handball players.
Of course
it
they
is.
Are.
It just happens. It just happens that way.
And it has nothing to do with God.
I'm getting all confused here, but what, let me see. Handball, the scam. Oh, yeah. And there's things like when I mention this, it's going to be like mentioning, as I always say, Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
Remember her? No. Who's that? But anyway, here. Enron. The Enron scandal.
People remember going, that?
Enron. What the hell was that? That's where this crooked, this crooked energy company came into the White House and essentially wrote the energy policy for the United States. And there was a website. Like I said at the beginning of the first Obama administration, if you disagreed with Obama, say by 2010, you'd say, "Well, what's wrong with Obama?" And like a conservative could say, well, he did this and he did that and he did this and he did that and he did that. You know, you could maybe get up to 6 or 7. There was a website. You may remember this, Jalene. It was called 1,000 Reasons.
Yeah.
And it was literally a list of 1,000 offenses against
Bush.
That Bush committed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of everything. Of giving away mine safety to the lobbyists for that industry that wound up in, 53 people being killed because they'd be, on and on. Allowing more arsenic in the water because his mine, on and on and on. So.
I'm sure if you Google it, you can still find it.
All right. And you know how many people are calling right now? Zero. And that's not bad. I just wanted to have my say.
Okay.
But
because you have them trained.
All right. Well, no, I mean about not to call in until 11:30. No, that's
but you can.
That's not just it. I think this is a big story for the media. I think that most people probably think, there they go again. All right.
Yeah.
Here's the big story, folks. You know the whole thing about don't drink and drive, right?
Well, you know, I'm pretty militant about that.
Yeah, and you know that I'm Jalene's designated driver whenever we go to a riff function.
I just won't drink and drive. I won't do it.
And you know I counter drinks. I mean, I don't even know why I counter drinks.
Because you're driving.
Yeah, yeah.
I should be counting years.
That's right. I said, you're having it. I sound like a wife. I said, you're having another one of those? They were making, remember that part? They were making those mojitos so strong. I had one.
Yeah.
I had one.
I had like three.
I know. I had one. And I'm thinking, I'm going to need a designated driver.
Yeah, I know.
But you think I'm a lightweight. Anyway.
You are.
All right. Here's the deal, folks. So get in on this. You're listening to Night Call. I'm Peter Werbe, Jalene Jordan here. And we're at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You know, I forgot all about this stuff. I didn't even give the basics. We never even said the phone number.
You know what?
What?
People know it by now?
Yeah. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Please join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. My website is peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And that's got some of the documents that I'm talking about, like why wasn't there any furor about when Bush used the IRS and the CIA and the FBI.
I'm going to get that up, all of that up on our Facebook eventually here throughout the evening.
Okay.
As well.
And John Miller, our assistant producer, and actually, who's our producer?
We're producer. He is.
Okay. John Miller, our producer. you haven't even like logged on to our little dialogue box here, John, in the other room. Give me a shout. I know you're there. Is he there? Yeah, he answered the phone. Good.
He's there.
Anyway, here's the big story. Riffers.
Yes, Riff Rockers.
Riff Rockers. The National Transportation Safety Board, that's the NTSB, said that they recommend that states reduce the allowable blood alcohol concentration to be reduced by more than a third to 0.05. Right now it's 0.08.
And it was 0.10.
But what happened was that they literally forced the states to reduce it. I can't see where that is. But
0.05 is like a half a drink, isn't it?
I was so shocked of what that is. Get this. Blood alcohol concentration varies by body weight, gender, stomach contents, and other factors. But generally speaking, a 180-pound man could consume 4 beers or 4 glasses of wine in 90 minutes without reaching the current limit. That's nuts.
Yeah, because from what I understand, it's from a police officer, it's for the average weighted person who has had food in their stomach. It's 1 drink per hour.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, if I had 4 beers in a year and a month and a half, I've got to get it down to an hour and a half. There you go.
Yeah, I was gonna say
to an hour and a half. I would be S-faced.
I'd like to see that. Let's do it. I can walk home.
I have never liked the alcohol high. I always use a little natural assistance.
You used to.
I used to experiment. Yeah. But no more.
It was a success, and you really have mellowed out.
Yeah. All right. I mean, I love to drink.
I know. You'll have your little gimlet.
I have a gimlet, a mojito, a gin and tonic.
I need to come over for a
drink. I like beer.
Drink on the patio, Peter.
I like beer. We got a party in the patio, the way ZZ Top says it. Yeah. Like wine. I mean, you know, if it's got alcohol in it, I like it.
I know. Me too.
But I don't like a lot. If I start getting a buzz, I stop. I know, whereas a lot of people, they get blotto.
Yeah.
But anyway, thousands of people are being killed or injured every year by drivers who have not reached the legal standard for being drunk. In other words, they have like a 0.056 or 7, but it's reduced their ability to see, make decisions, or operate a vehicle. That's according to the NTSB. So the current standard was established a year ago. Oh, here it is, right here. An instigation of Congress and progress has stalled, the board said, with about 10,000 fatalities a year. Foreign countries with stricter standards have had substantially more success, according to the board. The blood alcohol recommendation faces opposition, Sarah Longwell, the managing director of the American Beverage Institute, a restaurant trade association, called the idea ludicrous.
Well, I don't even know what to say about it. You know, like the whole, you know how I feel about drinking and driving. And I know people are better. They have improved. There is more awareness of it, you know, but I still am surprised by how many people just get completely wasted and drive.
They estimate that on a Saturday night in the United States, there is 20 million people driving
drunk
over the limit.
And as the night gets later,
Drunk? I mean, right now, you can be...
0.08.
Yeah, 0.08. So there's 20 million people. So it's almost like a national institution or something like that.
I drive better when I'm drinking. What do you mean?
I had a guy used to call here. He would say that. Yep. They also want to require that everyone convicted of drunken driving be required to install a breathalyzer interlock in their car that would prevent the vehicle from starting without an alcohol test. And this would be focused on heavy drinkers and repeat offenders. Can you imagine that, getting in the car with your boss?
Listen, I gotta blow real quick.
You drive, Sam. I gotta blow in here.
The thing is I'm not a prude, and I'm not trying to say not have fun, but I got busted for drunken driving in 1999. Full disclosure here on the Riff.
What was your?
I was at a Riff event, as a matter of
fact.
What'd you blow? Oh gosh. I think it was like, and this was when it was 0.10.
Yeah.
I think I did with it like a 0.12.
Yeah.
And he said, well, have you been drinking, ma'am? And I've been at a Riff event. This is back when I drank at my events. I don't do that anymore. Learned my lesson there. First of all, it's not part of the job. But anyhow, I did that, and it was before everything got really, really.
You're lucky because now
tough.
You get a.
It was six. I had a six. I spent 6 hours in jail, and it was awful.
Yeah.
Hey, Alan Park, what's up? And so 6 hours and $600 fine, and the biggest thing that happened out of that whole thing, Peter, is it changed my entire life because. I was a little reckless, I'm going to admit it. So that's the place I'm coming from. Just so.
Sure. I know a college professor, Wayne State professor, that blew like a 0.08.
Yeah.
It wound up thousands and thousands of dollars in legal costs. He's got all sorts of.
Well, it's just the whole thing. You can kill someone, you can kill yourself, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was in my 20s, oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, people, creatures, animals should be dead, for real. It was that way. And so I don't mean to be a preacher, but just get a dang ride or stay somewhere or take a cab. And
well, if you're talking to 20 million people that are driving drunk on a Saturday night, I mean, I agree. It's great advice. And everybody knows you're not supposed to do it. But this four beers in an hour and a half, I mean, that's something. Look, I want to say something before I say this to the people on hold. I mean, I am severely ADD, which is why I'm in this job. I can talk about subjects, you know, all over the place.
Yep.
If I had to be an accountant, I'd be in a padded cell.
So would I.
So many of you callers are so ADD, hang on the line. We'll get to you. I'm going to call your name out, David and Rob and Kim and Tim. You hang on. We'll get to you. It might be a little while. But
no, don't say it might be a little while. It's not going to be very long because we're going to do a commercial break in a minute.
I know.
And then we're going to take their phone calls,
Peter. We will. One of the things that the opponents of reducing this to 0.05, they say that the majority of fatalities are involved in accidents where drivers have over 0.15.
So, yeah, I would say 0.05 is excessive.
Well, here's what the woman from the beverage group says. Moving from 0.08 to 0.05 would criminalize perfectly responsible behavior.
Yeah.
And further restriction of moderate consumption of alcohol by responsible adults prior to driving does nothing to stop hardcore drunk drivers from getting behind the wheel. Well, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
On the other hand, you have this reduction in other countries when they've done that. People with a blood alcohol of 0.05 are 38% more likely to be involved in a crash than those who have not been drinking. People with a blood alcohol level of 0.08 are 169% more likely.
Whoa.
Yeah. The standard in most of the industrialized countries of the world is 0.05. What? But this is the USA!
That was the best! Yeah!
What is, you ever, there's a right-wing slogan that says, Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms ought to be a convenience store.
Oh, God.
not a federal department.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. 30% of all vehicle fatalities are tied to drunken driving, down from 50% when, guess who brought this up initially? President Ronald Reagan, 30 years ago. The number of deaths is down to about 10,000 a year from 21,000 over the same period. Highway deaths are decreasing overall because of better designed cars, seatbelt use, and better highways. All right, Riffers.
Be good.
Yeah. We're gonna leave you for just a minute or two. We're going to be back to get
your
calls.
We're going to take all those phone calls, and we do have a couple of open lines if you want to get in.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend is brought to you by The Big Bang Theory. Watch weeknights at 7 and 10 on CW50. The Riff.
Maloney is in the zone. From a right cross fakie, he transitions effortlessly to a frontside shoulder shot.
Holy mackerel! He is so gifted, I thought he was actually wearing his seatbelt.
Well, Dick, you're not trained to spot the tricks drivers use to avoid seatbelt tickets. Let's see if he can fool the police.
And that siren signals a resounding no.
There you have it. There's no trick to avoiding seatbelt tickets. Day and night, click it or ticket.
Take part with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Hey, babe. I know you're the chameleon with the great eye, so I wanted to talk about the color we painted the living room.
Oh, that new Cosmic Berry? It's great.
Yeah, it's good. But Valspar has the Love Your Color guarantee, so if we don't love it, we get another color free.
We do love it, so no need to change.
Are we certain we love it?
We love it. We didn't love having your mother stay with us for a month.
We didn't have a choice.
We are chameleons. We always have a choice.
Offer ends 10/7/13. See loveyourcolor.com for offer terms.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
101 WRIF. Oh,
yeah.
us your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back.
The things that go on during commercial breaks.
You know, some of these, not with Jalene and I. Well, yeah, but all professional folks. Yeah, you know, some of these talk shows, they have webcams. Phew.
Oh, I wouldn't like that.
No.
You know?
I'd have to comb my hair.
Me too.
Yeah.
No.
Like that. All right, listen, we are talking about what Bill Maher last Friday night called all these BS scandals, which I would agree. How about you? Do you think they're real scandals? I don't. I think they're just Republican frauding, doing anything to sabotage the Obama government in order to, you know, get their folks back in. Mm-hmm. You know, that could very well happen in 2014. But what the other thing we were talking about was this recommendation by the National Transportation Safety Board that the states reduce the allowable blood alcohol concentration by more than a third, down to 0.05 from what it is now, 0.08. And who's this woman here? She is from the American Beverage Institute. She says this would do nothing to stop hardcore drunk drivers from getting behind the wheel. So I want to take all the calls. We're going to talk about Benghazi and drunk driving.
Yeah, whatever you want to talk about. I'm talking to the
listeners. I thought you were talking with me. I would say, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Let's see. Here is David in Detroit. David, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Welcome.
Hey, gang. It's been a while. I think I can touch on all three in the short amount of time you'll give me. So,
all right, good luck.
I'll start with Jillian. What you said is absolutely right. It's ridiculous with this, what's going on. What I think is even worse is the priorities of law enforcement. You spent 6 hours in jail for essentially possibly putting somebody's life in danger. I spent 3 days in jail for growing marijuana and wasn't putting anybody's life in danger.
See,
so where's the priority?
Well, that was also like 15 years ago that it happened to me. So.
Yeah, no, I understand. So that's one. So two. I think this conversation, I think it's not a monumental scandal type of thing. You're right about that. But to say that the man and his administration is completely innocent would be false, too. I think what it proves is what libertarians have been saying this whole time, and that there's nothing, absolutely nothing special about this president. He is just cut from the same corruptible cloth as all the rest of them. It goes all the way back.
I would tend to agree, although there are degrees. You know, it's what I said before the election. I said that the best I can say about Obama, he's better than a stick in the eye, and the Republicans would have been and are, in fact, a stick in everybody's eye. But when you start, you know, all you got to do is, well, I don't know. Never mind. I'll just leave it at that general level. Give me your third thing.
Last one real quick, this IRS thing. What really irritates the hell out of me is that they're not talking about the larger picture, that this is a nasty, blood-sucking organization that we really should just end. And I'm going to propose to you, and I'm going to get your take on this. What do you think about a fair, uniform across the board where nobody escapes it, no black market, no rich person, a transaction tax? Tell me what you think.
Absolutely, sure. That would be great, particularly on Wall Street. All right. Thank you, David. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Rob Robinson, Trenton. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What do you think about lowering that level to 0.05?
This is my take on it. You know what? Lower it down, because most of the politicians that operate everywhere are career drunks. And they're going to get all smacked up in it. And I'm going to laugh my ass off.
I love all these perspectives. That was unique. I liked it.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate
they're
that.
They're doing a little drinking there.
Some lines opening up from the guys that just dropped off. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Kim. Kim's in Highland. Kim, hi. You're on the air.
Hi.
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 Okay. Dave, did you just call about the president?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you something what's special about this president. He is not out to get you like the previous one. His heart's in the right place. He's up against those crazy Republicans, and he would do more if he could. Well, you know that Bush, all he cared about is his cronies and how he's going to screw us.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That is all he cares
You know
about.
What? I think Barack Obama's heart is in the right place. But, you know, I hate to say it, Kim. I don't think that's enough. He's just not tough enough on it all. He had first 2 years, he had a real opportunity. He's conflict shy, I think, where he needed to be tough. He keeps just kind of knuckling under to a lot of this stuff.
Like drones.
Yeah. Drones. I agree. He does cave. He does do that. And I don't know. As far as the IRS thing goes, I wish sometimes people would just say, yeah, so what?
Well, couldn't happen to a nicer group of people. The teabaggers. All right, Kim, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Hey, by the way, a little while from now, I'm going to get the rest of these calls right now, but I found an interesting piece on Alternet. That's alternet.org. 9 questions that atheists might find insulting.
See, we are insulted too. We feel insulted as well.
Yeah. Here's Carl in Mount Clemens. Carl, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good, thanks.
Good. Julian, sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
Due to gun control. I know you're talking about drinking and driving and all that stuff, but gun control.
Yeah.
You can't control that. But however, if people have to register a car and do what they have to do, can they come up with an organization? I mean, what about insurance purposes?
You mean have gun owners have insurance?
Right.
That's been suggested.
Do a breathalyzer for, like, before they purchase a gun?
Or maybe when you go out, you ought to, yeah. I mean, that doesn't seem to mix well, guns and alcohol.
That's all I needed to, I don't own one. I'm just heartbreaking by hearing all the stories of everything that's going on with people losing their lives, innocent people.
Yeah.
Innocent people, and it's just getting, it's been getting old for years.
And what, I don't know what people think when they look at our country. I mean, all they got to do is, listen, let's make our show international. I mean, we've got people, just a few miles away from here that live in pretty much, a gun-free society. And they don't have, presidents, whether it's Bush or Obama, having their government, and secret agencies going after opposition. So, and they don't have very many guns, people, anywhere like, we do. And, they seem as free as us. Some people might even say freer. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Whoa, wait a minute. Aren't we the freest country in the world? Well, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
I mean, it's not just my opinion. I mean, there are statistics.
Just look around.
Well, besides looking around, I mean, there's these indexes that rate overall freedom. And the United States is sure not at the top. I mean, the largest prison population, one of the highest violence of any industrialized country, on and on. I mean, what we got to look at is not, you know, how can we keep the government, get my gun. What we got to do is, why is there so much wrong with this country? Maybe I even got an idea about that. I'll talk about that in just a little while.
I mean, people talk about other countries that are violent, and I'm not saying they're not, like the violence toward women and the way women are treated in certain countries around the world. But the violence, we are up there on the violence measure there.
Here's Stan in Birmingham. Stan, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I just want to talk about the drunk driving thing there.
Yeah, the fact that they want to raise, lower it to 0.05 from 0.08. What do you think?
I'm thinking it's just a racket to make money.
Get more money in the coffers from drunk driving?
That costs people, $10,000 every time that happens or whatever, and I don't know where that money goes to, lawyers or fines. Yeah. I mean, I know
fines are most of it, I think, now. And then they have to pay every time they go take their breathalyzer test.
Yeah.
And
so that's big money.
And lawyers,
And I think there's something. Do you have to put something on your license plate?
No, they talked about that, but I don't think they did that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard something about that, but I don't think they actually went through with all that.
Exactly. You know, no one's answered this. They say right now, tell me, Stan, what you think about this. They say a 180-pound man, I weigh 175, could consume 4 beers or glasses of wine in 90 minutes without reaching 0.08. I got to believe, if I had four beers in 90 minutes, I'd be saying, stand, buddy.
I would think that depends on his content or whatever.
What's in the contents of the stomach and the body mass. For example, I'm 5'2".
You know, eyes are blue.
Eyes are blue, weigh about, I don't know, 120 pounds, maybe.
Ooh.
And it does not take me very much. You know,
right,
girlfriend can get a buzz quite easily.
I know. If I get a mixed drink in the afternoon, I start to feel a little buzz.
I see your face. It gets so red and cute.
And it also
it's the Irish
on,
in me.
It also depends on if you're a drinker or not. I mean, if you have a high
tolerance
for it, you know, it's not going to bother you as much as a.
No, I know.
You know, yeah.
Well, no, listen, I know high functioning alcoholics, particularly one guy that I can't believe how much booze he puts away every single day, and he's high functioning.
Yeah.
You know, like that, and he—I don't know—is he impaired? Stan, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I don't know. Oh, yeah. In New Mexico, New Mexico has had one of the highest rates of alcohol-related traffic deaths in the nation. So they're really going after it. They got an aggressive new bill that would forbid many people convicted of drunken driving from buying alcohol anywhere. Stores, restaurants, or bars. If it passes, it would be among the most restrictive drunken driving laws in the nation. Under a 2005 New Mexico law, people convicted of drunken driving are required to install ignition interlock devices on their vehicle, typically for 1 year, for a first offense. Drivers have to breathe into the device to start the ignition. Has anybody ever seen that? That
yes.
Sort of, really?
Yeah, I've known people who've had it.
In a private car?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
you know who I wanted to get on here? Okay, sorry. I was just looking at, I want to get all of you on here. The current proposal would expand that measure, barring thousands of New Mexicans who are required to have the devices from buying alcohol at all. Drivers with the interlocks would be issued a specially marked license, it says. So you would think license plate, indicating they are prohibited. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. They're going to card people that look 50 years old? I don't think so.
I don't know.
I don't get it.
Maybe under the law they'll have to.
We're a bunch of drunks.
Maybe everyone's going to get carded.
Yeah. Here's Tim in Roseville. Tim, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Peter.
What, did I not do it? I didn't.
Yeah.
All right, okay. There we go. Hey, Tim, you're on the air. Sorry.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening to you. What's up?
Hi, I was just listening to your show there and hearing a few comments. And on the end of that, I'm for lowering the drinking, limit.
Uh-huh.
And mainly because there's too many people out there taking advantage of, you know, drinking and going out driving and getting themselves in trouble or, you know, hurting or killing other people.
That's right.
And then a lot of these people are just walking away with no punishment.
You know, other than money.
I don't know, Tim. I haven't really paid much attention to it, but people that do some grievous injury to other people while drunk, I think they get some pretty bad sentences. There's a WDIV, I can't remember his name, WDIV reporter who's been in jail since April 10th. I mean, I think he got like 90 days in jail.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. Well, the people that are just going out and drinking and, you know, having a good time and then just end up getting stopped by the police, you know, yeah, they go through a little court system, have to pay a little fine, but I know a few people that have gone through this process and they've just basically got slapped in the hand and they keep going back and doing the same thing over and over. And this is why people are getting killed out there. And, I mean, but the levels need to be revamped, but also the punishment tiers that affect, you know, the people with the different blood level of alcohol, I think should be revamped also, you know, to reflect on, you know, how drunk these people are. And then also the punishments need to be adhered to. I mean, I'm no lawyer, I'm no judge, I'm no legal analyst or anything like that, but I don't know how it could be done to keep these people behind, you know, out from behind the wheels, but somehow it needs to be done.
Well, I'm just fearful that you know, we keep running into these intractable problems. As I said earlier, they estimate that at any given Saturday night, there's 20 million people driving over the limit. And booze is, I don't know if I'm trying to think if it's any different than any Western industrial country. Maybe not, but we love our beer. We love our alcohol, our spirits. We mm-hmm. love our wine and all of that. And increasingly, it's playing, I would say, a larger role. That now there's starting to be all these boutique breweries.
Like craft beers. And
craft
things.
Beers, boutique distilleries. You know,
places to go during.
Our friends up in Ferndale, Valentine's.
We love
now,
them, Valentine's Vodka.
Yeah, and they're also making gin and I think a whiskey now as well.
Well, if we go, you're driving, and if I want to, if I want their vodka, I'll buy a bottle and take it home.
Okay. All right, Tim, thank you for your opinion.
It's good
I appreciate
stuff.
It.
I'm going to give a little bit of a shout out to the Valentine vodka.
Right. Thank you, John Miller, our producer and phone screener, who's getting your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
He tells us WDIV reporter Kevin Dietz, super drunk DUI, jailed since April 18th.
Wow.
So that's a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. What does super drunk mean? I mean
well, there's, right. no, there, there's,
oh, there's,
it's a term.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, if you're over a certain amount. John, what is that? But I don't know. I wasn't super drunk. I was stupid drunk, maybe, you know, 1999. I was stupid, that's for sure.
Okay, here is an interesting concept. Katie from Pinckney wants to talk about what happens if it's a small woman. Katie, hi, you're on the air. What do you got to say about this?
Hey, how are you?
We're good.
Well, you know, they want to lower the limit. Fine, lower the limit. But on the flip side, I'm 5 foot tall. I'm 110 pounds on a good day. So that means that I have to be super nervous and careful if I want to go out and have, you know, a drink or two with my girlfriend.
Like you can just have, like, one. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but who wants to have just one?
Yeah, well, just you got to find a way around it. You got to take a cab. You need to do something.
Yeah.
I just think there's putting away is completely reasonable. And I work in a bar, so I get to see a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same token, what do you do for those of us who aren't, quote, unquote, average size? You know, my grandfather is 84 years old, and he got busted, maybe 3 weeks ago.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
84, had three rum and cokes, blew a .09, and he is now facing the whole kit and caboodle with the $10,000 and the driver's classes and everything for a .09.
And also with a man of that age, people are always suspicious of their capabilities, and I think unfairly. I think this is, both... Fairly and unfairly, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, so he had three rum and cokes. Did you say in
how long?
How long a period? Do you know?
It was over a few hours.
Well,
he sits and he chats with his buddies and everything.
Well, so that's what I was saying. That doesn't make sense. They're saying that you can have
Grandpa
four beers in 90 minutes and still be under .08. I think that's
maybe
nuts.
If you've had a huge steak dinner and potatoes.
Yeah, and you're
weighing
290. No, but this was for a 180-pound person.
Yeah, it's unreasonable. I mean, fine, if you want to lower it, lower it, but at least be reasonable about it.
Katie, let me ask you this. You say you work in a bar. Did they still cut people off? Are there people that the bar will say, I'm sorry, I'm not serving you anymore?
Or can we get you a cab?
Would you say yes?
And we offer both, yes.
And I bet
we will offer to call you a cab, and you were talking about carding people over 50. I card everybody.
Really?
Yes, because it's better safe than sorry. I would rather card you at 70 years old than risk losing my job on a police thing.
Yeah, wow.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and do people ever, I mean, if you're kind of drunk, if people say, we're not serving you, you're not serving me anymore.
Oh, yeah, usually they're pretty reasonable, but you get those special occasions where they will just cuss you out and chew you out, and you're just the worst person in the world. And you know what? You just have to understand you can't reason with a drunk, shrug it off your shoulders, and, sir, I'm sorry, I have to follow the rules, and if you can't follow the rules, you can't play the game.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that happens in the... what city is the bar in that you work, if I can ask?
Pinckney.
In Pinckney, okay.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a lot of wide open spaces, but it's no less true.
They're trying to take those back roads home.
Well, yeah.
But you know what? They're patrolled. They're patrolled left and right.
But you know what I was thinking, Katie? Probably a lot of people come to the bar each in an individual automobile.
And on boats, because we're on a lake.
Oh, okay. So,
then there's that whole drunken thing.
Yeah, all right.
And they get nailed on the boats, too.
Yeah, they do.
Wow. Okay, thanks for all the info.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good. Bar and a lake.
Tell Grampy.
Yeah.
No more driving.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's probably his butt on that, I would I would say. Oh, yeah, wait a minute here. John Miller's been doing more. Super drunk for first offense is 180 days in jail. Super drunk law in Michigan is 0.17.
0.17. Yeah.
Yeah, 0.17. Yeah. That's.
Yeah.
We can also call that 0.17.
Okay.
0.17. Maybe that's probably better said like that. Anyway, let's move on. We got to move on.
Commercials.
Commercials, yeah. Hang in there. Rick and James, you are next. We'll continue to talk about this. But you will never believe who has a female fan club. That and more.
Is it me? Go to the commercial.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Hey, Motor City. Welcome, Lindsay, your 2013 Riff Rock girl. Check out all her details and some great picks from the finals party online at WRIF.com.
Hey, if you're not wearing your seatbelt, avoiding a ticket has a high degree of difficulty.
Real, though.
No matter what trick you pull to appear wearing one. The front side shoulder sham, a gnarly right cross fakie, or even the seriously wicked smooth glide shift. Cops make sure each trick finishes with a busted tail grab. That's harsh, man. Pulling a fakie will get you in real trouble. There's no trick to avoiding a seatbelt ticket. Day and night, click it or tick it.
A form of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Hey, babe. I know you're the chameleon with the great eye, so I wanted to talk about the color we painted the living room.
Oh, that new Cosmic Berry? It's great.
Yeah, it's good. But Valspar has the Love Your Color guarantee, so if we don't love it, we get another color free.
We do love it, so no need to change.
Are we certain we love it?
We love it. We didn't love having your mother stay with us for a month.
We didn't have a choice.
We are chameleons. We always have a choice.
Offer ends 10/7/13. See loveyourcolor.com for offer terms.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
Suicide.
Wine Guard's gift card and maybe score the grand prize, a backyard barbecue bash and a Toro Time Master wide area mower. Visit a Wine Guard's location in Ann Arbor, Farmington Hills, Utica, or Clarkston. Details at WRIF.com. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. Boy, my computer's not working very well at all. I wanted to announce the guests I'm going to have at 1 a.m., and I can't seem to get this up, but a couple of interesting ones, including Steve Babson from, let me see if I can do this all from memory, from Detroit Eviction Defense. It's a group that's been taking on the banks and...
I guess mine's not working very well either.
Maybe it's in here.
Maybe it's a slow thing going on.
Fannie Mae and... what's the other one? Fannie Mae, the big mortgage holder and its responsibility in the amazing amount of foreclosures all around in Detroit and in the area. And they, the people from Fannie Mae had agreed to come in and talk at Local 600, at the Ford Local 600, and sit down with Detroiters and hear their complaints and what they thought the problem was, and they just bailed out on them. It's still going to happen. The event's still going to happen. You go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and go to the calendar page, and all the information is there. And the other one, but I can remember it. An incredible guy, Doug Peacock. And he's written a book called In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, about America's first people, about the people that came across the land bridge from Asia and populated this, and, you know, archaeologists say.
But this is more about global warming.
And it's about global warming, indeed. You got it up there?
It says, a renegade naturalist considers global warming the first Americans and the terrible beasts of the
Pleistocene.
Says today's climate change is similar to what the earliest people on the North American continent faced, and their adoptive reaction bears lessons for us.
Yes, and I don't know if people are familiar with the book called The Monkey Wrench Gang, but it's an incredible book by a naturalist author, Edward Abbey. And Doug Peacock was the model for the character, the main character, who took part in all this eco sabotage to stop, ripping down the forest and
tree spiking, whatever.
All right, but back to the idea. Oh yeah, wait a minute. I was going to tell you about
we're taking your phone calls. Yeah, so hang on the line.
Yeah, the female fan club for an extraordinarily undeserving.
This is unreal.
Yeah. There is a huge fan club for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev. That's right.
That's one of the alleged Boston.
Well, I don't say
bombers.
Alleged. I'm going to call him the Boston Bomber, surviving Boston Bomber. Let him sue me. The majority of Americans, just his name and the face, his face. You know, at first he looked so innocent.
Yeah.
After you look at it for a while.
Not so much.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Anyway, he has a fan club.
Women
have the hots for him.
Supporters have set up special Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr pages in his honor. I'm not even going to give you the hashtag. The fans declare his innocence, refer to him by his nickname of Jahar, write about how they wish they could get in touch with him, and in one case, curl up and take a nap in his soft hair.
Wow.
Yeah. They publicize items like hand-beaded free Jahar bracelets. Note that he's beautiful, hot, and too pretty to be guilty. One Kansas teen even told the New York Post that she was going to get a Tsarnaev, quote, tattooed on her arm, though she soon after changed her mind. What's she going to say? Attack on one Muslim is an attack on all Muslims?
God.
That's what he'd written in the boat.
Right.
So what is up with people? I don't get it. All right, back to the DUI thing, driving under the influence. And the question is, should the limit be lowered, as the National Transportation Safety Board has suggested, that the allowable blood alcohol content, the BAC, be reduced by more than a third to 0.05% from 0.08. So let's go back to that. Here is Rick in Farmington Hills. Rick, hi. Welcome, and thanks for your patience.
Peter.
Yep, I guess I'm not hitting it well. Sorry.
Hit the button.
Hit the button. Oh, I see what. You know what? This is not happening. Oh, Rick, just hold on. I'm clicking it.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I think I can do it by. I'll have to do it by hand. Here. Hey, Rick. Hi, you're on the air. Hi, you're on the air. Yeah, we're having a little problem here.
Okay.
Yeah, but wait a minute. I wonder if you're going out over the air.
I don't know.
I don't know
either.
You're
in your headphones. He is.
What? Okay, Jolene says you are. So go ahead. Okay. You're on the air.
How you doing? I just wanted to comment on the lady that was talking about. And then somebody said the president ain't too soft and everything.
You know what, Rick? I was saying the same thing though. What do you think?
Yeah, but I wanted to say, what if the brother really came hard? You know, I mean, like the Rock say, boot to boo boo and stuff. And you know, when those guys, the lady. That was the governor down in Arizona. She was punching him. What if Secret? He just told Secret, sir, handle this. Break her fingers and stuff. The guy that called him a liar and stuff. Go up there, punch him out. What would people do then?
Well, I know. People have said then, you know, that if he was aggressive, they'd say he was an angry black man and, you know, and all this stuff. You know, hey, he doesn't have to be reelected, and he was going very eloquently talking about his experience as an African American, you know, for at what was it, Wilberforce? What college? He was at a college just the other day, making I think on Saturday. So, but you know what? Who would say that? The right wingers, and they don't have anything good to say about him anyway. If they're going to add a race thing to it. You know, I mean,
I think Caucasians, and forgive me for saying it like this, I think they expect black men to be angry and stuff.
Sometimes they're right to be.
Yeah, but maybe it takes a whole lot to get me angry.
Yeah, well.
Takes a whole lot to get me angry. But when I do get angry, I'm justified at what comes out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe it's not good for him to do that.
Well,
but
you know what? But wait, well, I'm sorry for interrupting. You know, you can have aggressive policies without being angry. You know, you can just say, look, yeah, we're not putting up with this. I'm not, you know, these guys have insulted me. They have no intent of compromising.
Yeah.
But, you know, remember Truman. I mean, I don't remember, but he would say the no good, good for nothing 86 mm-hmm. Congress or whatever, because that maybe does sound a little angry.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's wild, man. It's wild.
I mean, nowhere fast is the problem, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, that was just a thought that I have. And the thought about alcohol, hey, if you can't handle it, don't drink.
I got you.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys be good.
Or
always. All right. Thank you, Rick.
Sorry, I had to leave the studio for a moment. But
so,
we're all good. You're just going to have to go manually from the board.
Yeah. All right. I guess, do we know what's happening?
We do not, because we're in the middle of the show.
We're in the middle of the show. Okay. I did want to get now, but John looked up all this information about the super drunk law in Michigan. As we said, it's 0.17, and the DIV reporter, and this I can only see a little section of his screen now, has been in jail since April 18th, and it says super drunk for the first offense is 180 days in jail.
Wow.
Which is, let me do, what's the math?
Makes my whole 6 hours look pretty light.
Yeah. What is that, 6 months? Six times three, one, yeah. Right. I can't do math.
No.
Yeah, that's 6 months. 360 hours of community service, up to 1 year license suspension, alcohol treatment, and ignition interlock. Well, you know what? I got to tell you, no sympathy, because somebody...
You shouldn't be that wasted in driving, period.
I mean, they're talking about 0.08 being impaired, and this guy is blowing 0.17. Yikes. All right. So we... Oh, you know what's happening, though? I can't...
Yeah, just keep going over here.
Yeah.
One, line 1, 3, and 4.
I understand that, but
okay.
If you see... But see, Rick's name is still on the...
Okay, but...
Okay, all right.
This is how it's going to go.
Okay.
Until we reboot during
the
commercial break.
Okay. Hopefully...
I am being your producer now, Peter.
You are. This is James in Imlay City. James, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Hey, I just wanted to make a quick comment on the lowering the alcohol content.
Sure, please.
Hey, I'm just getting sick and tired of people actually saying that, you know, I'm a professional drunk driver. I can always handle alcohol when I'm driving.
And isn't
I'm
that like, amazing?
What are you talking about? That doesn't even make any sense.
No.
Yeah, because it's total crap.
Oh, yeah, and the crazy part is I work at a tire store, and when I get inside in and out of a lot of cars during the day, and when I sit down inside some of these cars, they got open beverages just sitting there right in the center console.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. What babies in the back seat?
Oh, yeah, there's a half-cold beer sitting there, and for those interlock systems, I've actually gotten in a few cars, and I can't start it, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? So I had to call the customer over, and they're like, oh, I have to blow into the car. So while I'm standing out there waiting for them, they're blowing into this thing for like 10 seconds, and finally, you know, they're like, okay, now you can start it. And they act like it's normal. I'm like, this isn't embarrassing to you? Like,
yeah, it must be.
You have to come out here and blow into this to start your own vehicle. Like,
You could do? You could have, you know, like you have a designated driver, you could have a designated blower.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it works. I think there's a way.
That's illegal.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, if you can get away with that.
Say, I know a young woman late teens, that has an ankle bracelet.
Yeah.
That was put on.
Like a tether?
Thank you. That actually senses alcohol.
Where you are? Oh, if you have alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lilo. Oh, Lindsay Lohan had that one.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
If you have a passenger blowing into that thing, you'll go to jail for a long time. I mean, that's against, when they install that into your vehicle, they tell you, you know, you're the only one blowing into this, and if anyone else does, you can go to prison.
Wow. Okay. So. Well, good to know. Thank you. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's see. We got a...
go to line four.
Yes. Okay. The reason... I just sound like I'm bumbling. I'm bumbling because this whole system on the board isn't working.
Well, the thing is that the computer, you have a frozen situation over
right
there.
Right, so I'm having to stretch across this board and put people
so
on the air.
Peter, are you going to be okay?
God. I don't know. This job is hell.
I don't know. See these guys on road construction crews sweating their asses off, and you're like, I got to reach across this board.
Hey, I expect more support from you than this. All right, here's Lucas and Taylor. Lucas, hi, you're on the air. What do you think about this DUI and lowering the BAC, the blood alcohol content level?
I think it's going to hurt beer sales quite a bit.
Maybe more people will drink at home. I mean, for bars and restaurants, for sure.
Yes, that is exactly why the American Beverage Institute is opposed to it, because it'll make all of us think, let me see, I should have had and what have you.
Bars might need to offer more rides, like free rides and incentives and things like that, you know? I mean,
to
hire a driver.
I've worked in restaurants and bars majority of my life, and I do know the fact that, and I actually went to culinary school and learned a lot about alcohol, and, like, there's a law that says if there's lights, and they say, like, red light, yellow light, green light, that you're actually only allowed to serve people. And when the people get to a certain point of intoxication, you have to cut them off. And if you do not cut them off, you can get in big trouble.
You're liable.
Actually.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, and you're liable for anybody. I mean, anybody who's drinking your facility, if you don't call them a cab or something and you let them walk out the door, you're liable. If they go get in a car and crash your car, you're liable.
Yeah, if I had my own restaurant, I think I would have no alcohol.
All right. Thank you, Lucas. Yeah.
It'd be breakfast and lunch.
Celine, call me a cab.
You're a cab.
Thank you. Now, we got to go to the top of the stack. I'm not sure whether this is the person. Hi, you're on the air. I think I'm going to have to ask you who you are and where you're calling from because I can't see here on my board. Who's this?
Bob.
Bob, hi. Where are you calling from, Bob?
I'm actually on the road right now driving from Toledo.
Okay, Bob, turn your radio completely off, will you?
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
It's off.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just want to say I'm a bartender, and I know it's not a very positive stance, but I think that I agree with the Fed lowering the alcohol limit, and
okay.
I
I would honestly say that I think that one drink impairs someone.
Yeah. Well, they say.
And I have, I come from a family of law enforcement, and I'm under the impression that if you want to stand at the legal limit to drive, it's about one beer every 45 minutes and a mixed drink every hour and 15 minutes. And both my brothers are law enforcement. They said out of all the fatality crashes that they've ever seen, majority of them are alcohol.
Yeah.
And I think that I support it. I think that people shouldn't. I think if you're going to go drink, I think that you should be an adult and figure out how you're going to get around. Don't drink and then think about how you're going to get around. I think that you shouldn't have one drink and drive because one drink impairs you.
You know what's a shame?
I kind of agree with him.
Well, what's a shame is the nature of our society. And what I was talking about, the woman who was the bartender in Pinckney, Katie, was it? That we live in an automobile society. I remember when I was in England quite a few years ago, you know, everybody would just get blotto and then everyone would walk home. There wasn't a single person.
Yeah.
There wasn't a single person
driving. Right. He can't help himself repeatedly.
Yeah. But that's it. The old idea of the neighborhood saloon or the neighborhood bar that you can just, walk to. I know some people, you know, in Ferndale, in fabulous Ferndale that do that, that live close.
I used to live right down the street from the New Way Bar.
The New Way Bar.
Yeah, which my friend Tina just sold just after sold, yeah. Something like 75 years or something
in
like that.
In the family. She's not there.
In the family. Yeah. 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 And, you know, I was 10 houses down. And was I there a lot? Yeah.
All right, Bob, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here, let's get our next caller on. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Peter. It's Paul from Plymouth.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
You're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to share with you guys. About a month ago, the state of Michigan was going to return the limit to 0.10. And
wow.
The federal government, of course, held over our head $50 million in national transportation highway funds. And if we didn't keep it at 0.08, that we would not receive those $50 million.
Sure.
So, of course, we kept it at 0.08. I personally don't agree with lowering it to 0.05. I think it's a money grab for our court systems. It's one of our biggest money gainers for the systems and law enforcement right now. And I think it's wrong. It's going to kill businesses. I don't think anyone at 0.05 is going to hurt anyone out there on the road. In fact, I think it's going to ruin people's lives. You know, it's just too low, if you ask me. And I think the woman from the Beverage Association is correct.
Now, let's compare this to remember when they stopped allowing smoking in establishments, and they were saying kind of the same thing about that. Remember that?
Yes. But, you know, their goal is zero tolerance. That's what they're shooting for. And if we're going to think we're not going to have people out there, licensed establishments serving people, and expect them, like, to not drive, that's unrealistic. And that's their goal.
Well, two things. One, what do you think about their contention that driving it down from 0.10 to 0.08 has actually reduced significantly the number of people killed? And it says, I mean, I'm just reading this here. I mean, you know, the figures, there's, you know, statistics. People with a blood alcohol content of 0.05 are 38% more likely to be involved in a crash than those who have not been drinking. According to government statistics, people with a blood alcohol of 0.08% are 169% more likely to get in crashes than if you hadn't been drinking at all. And, wow. And our last caller just said, even if you have one drink, you're impaired.
I agree. I think you are impaired. But I don't think that – I think we all have some sort of level of responsibility and know our limits. I mean, how can you judge 0.05 for a 100-pound woman or a 200-pound man? The blood alcohol could be completely different.
Sure.
And I think this is a big money grab. I honestly do, and I think it's wrong. I mean, do you guys support zero tolerance? I mean, that's, to me, unrealistic.
Zero
that's
tolerance?
What do you mean? In other words,
what's the issue?
No, he's talking about for alcohol. So, no, you should not be able to drink and drive at all, not even one drink.
No.
That is the direction they're heading, is zero tolerance, which is zero blood alcohol. And I think it's wrong. And that's where we're going. And
I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I don't even know that that's the direction they're going. And I think the other statistic, and I'm not trying to beat you up with these, I'm just reading what's here. Where did it say that? Almost every other country has it at 0.05. I mean, the fact, and I'm willing to bet that it was these Republicans that wanted to actually raise it to 0.10.
Could I ask you guys a question?
Sure.
Of course.
Should each state have their own rights of what they set it at themselves, or should we be dictated by the federal government?
Well, you know what? That has to do, you know, you go back to, like, the gun deal. So you have some states that are very restrictive in their gun ownership and registration and all of that. And then you have states like Virginia and Mississippi and all that where it's very lax. And then you have, everybody that wants guns, particularly illegally. In New York City, they'll have people go down to Virginia, go down to Mississippi, and buy 20 guns mm-hmm. and come up and sell them. Yeah, there should be certain things that I think that have national standards. I mean, you know, because one of the things that happens that there's been, I mean, this whole states' rights argument. I mean, I would not like to put up for a vote, for instance, minimum wage to state by state. Are you going to wind up with a lot of states where it's going to be $2 an hour?
Well. Should the federal government be able to hold back $50 million for our roads? I think that's wrong.
That's what they do, and that's how they got everybody to drop it. Bill Clinton signed a law in 2000 that withheld, as you're saying, highway construction money from states that did not agree to that standard, and as you indicated and told us that when they tried to do it here, they said, hey, you're going to lose a lot of money. So, yeah, I guess it's called political blackmail, huh?
Hey, I love the show, guys, always.
And it makes it great by people like you calling in. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye now. All right. You know what we should do? Why don't we take a break right now, reboot our computer, and get it back. All right.
And encourage people, because we have open lines. This is our final segment coming up for tonight, 313-298-9743.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF. Lock it in. Everything that rocks.
Ever hear somebody say, we can do this the easy way, or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bid online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
101 WRIF. Oh, yeah.
your night call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. We're back with a completely rebooted computer, and I can see everybody.
It's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah. At 1 a.m. Eastern time, about a half an hour, Steve Babson joins me via a recording that I did earlier in the week from the Detroit Eviction Defense. And this is a group that takes on the banks and takes on the giant mortgage companies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And
thank you. How can we think of that?
I don't know. And they were, and the responsibility they have for the enormous amount of foreclosures in the Detroit area. On the recording that Steve Babson talks about how today they the people, representatives from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, pardon me, are going to meet with people at Local 600 to discuss the issues, and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have backed out. They said some of these people will be involved in legal legal action against the mortgage giants, so they don't want to be there. Also, Doug Peacock. In the shadow of the saber tooth, a renegade naturalist considers global warming, the first Americans, and the terrible beasts of the Pleistocene. Interesting story. Interesting guy. He was.
Sounds so funny. The terrible beasts of the Pleistocene.
Yeah, they had bears that, when it was on all fours, were 7 feet high, not standing up.
What?
Yeah, they were huge animals during the Pleistocene. And there was this big die-off of, there were mammoths and mastodons and all that.
Yeah. I remember that from, third grade or something. Yeah.
And Doug Peacock, he was an anti-war activist. He's probably about 70 years old. He was an anti-war activist at the University of Michigan, and he joined the Green Berets as a medic.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
A combat medic. He said he wanted to see what he was protesting against, and he wanted to do it in a capacity to help people. Well, he was pretty shell-shocked, and he wound up spending 15 years when he came back in the wilderness.
Wow.
Which is his passion.
My gosh.
All right. Here's something I want to get on right away because does this tell me I know. This is a very weird little.
I think you should do it on the board.
Yeah. No, there we go.
There we go.
Yeah, almost here. Having little computer problems, folks. But
I just love when it happens on live radio.
You know, we used to
so
do
awesome.
It.
Awesome.
You know, we used to do it back in the day.
I held up a sign that said, Joe, line one.
That's right.
We've come a long way.
Here's Dave. He's in Wild Horse,
not
Colorado.
Clicking. It's not clicking, Peter.
Okay, let me try it again. Oh, yeah, there we go. Whoop. Wait a minute. I can do it. Wait a minute.
There
you go.
Hey.
Dave, you're on the air. Sorry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Welcome to amateur radio.
Yeah, I hope this works. I'm not in the middle of nowhere, but I hear you. I'm a truck driver. I don't actually live here, population about 50. But truck drivers, CDL in general, the blood alcohol limit is 0.04.
Wow.
And there's talk about dropping it to zero, like officially. There are a lot of companies now where if they catch wind of you being red at anything above zero, they fire you. I mean, any drinking at all. Now,
well, as you are kind of working for them, right?
Yeah.
You're on the job.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when it comes to drugs, for instance, I've heard it said that employer has the right to a drug-free workplace. In other words, when you're there, or particularly when you're doing something involving transportation, but a drug-free workforce is none of their business. In other words, what you do on your off hours,
as long as it's not affecting your job.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah.
What do you think? I know that I get real sleepy when I drink.
It wouldn't even cross my mind. I mean, I'm not a drinker at all anyway, so it wouldn't affect me.
Yeah.
I buy a six-pack, it lasts me a year and a half.
rather than an hour and a half like some people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Also, real quick, I stopped so I could talk, but I got to keep going. I sent you a link. I hope you can find it. John Howard, a conservative prime minister of Australia, wrote an article in the New York Times. I sent you a link.
Okay.
1996, Australia banned all assault weapons under Howard, and he was his conservative party. His base was not in the liberal cities; it was out in the goat ropes.
Right, right.
You know, out in the middle of nowhere. I don't know if you've talked about that before, but I think it's a great story.
I'll take a look at it. Yeah.
Most countries have a lot stricter gun laws than we do, you know, and the argument is always, you know, the criminals take over and the fascists take over and all this stuff if we don't have tons of guns to protect ourselves. But if there aren't guns in the first place, then the bad guys don't ever seem to get them. You know, Finland, Germany, France, they're not fascist dictatorships, and you can't just have a gun.
Right. Same with Canada. All right. Hey, Dave, thanks for calling, and drive safe. It sounds like you are. All right. Have a great night. Yeah, that's for sure. They are that the rate, although there's some dispute about the rate of mass murders and all of that after some terrible ones in Australia went down significantly when they put real restrictions on gun ownership. Here is Stuart in Grosse Pointe. Stuart, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I had a problem. I went to a restaurant one time.
Yeah?
I had all kinds of screwdrivers, you know, and I thought maybe it was the alcohol. I just couldn't eat anymore.
Uh-huh.
And then I figured it must be the orange juice because it dawned on me, of course, OJ would kill my appetite.
Why would OJ? Oh, God.
That was so bad.
That was bad. All right, thanks.
That was really bad.
Let's see. Paul,
keep your day job. Yeah, keep your day job.
Paul, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Paul from East Point.
Yeah,
it's you,
dude.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It's your time.
No, too cool, man. If I could get a recording of this, but at the same time, no, man. You know what? People got to be responsible for what the heck they do.
Yeah.
If it makes any sense.
Yeah.
Whether you drink, you know, if you're driving, if you're at home, wherever the hell you go. But one thing they should do is have a test. And, you know, you're probably going to laugh because I'm going to make a joke at the same time.
It's like the guy
getting ready for that button over there.
Yeah, you know, they got like a motorcycle guy on a motorcycle. You got to go through these cones, you know.
Yeah.
And then, oh, man, if you pass the test, you don't hit one cone. Well, what if they had a test like that where you go, how many beers does it take in order to hit one of them cones? Hey, you passed. Now you punch your card. Oh, it takes six beers for this guy to get too screwed up. But at the same time, what about these idiots on the cell phones, too, at the same time?
Well, texting for sure.
Yeah.
I don't talk on the phone in my car. I do not. But I don't have one of these fancy things where I can plug it in and like Peter does.
Well, that's a sync system, S-Y-N-C, that comes on Fords. And they say even that is distracting.
It is distracting.
Yeah. And you can do it hands-free. You can even dial hands-free and what have you and all that. All right. That would put quite a line at the testing stations, Paul, but I'm glad you're thinking about it.
But it's an idea. I mean, you know.
All right. One of the things I wanted to talk about, this was absolutely incredible. You know, we're looking at a situation where, as we've talked about so much, is that no matter what the right wing and the conservatives say, they've really pretty much triumphed in the last 30 years. And that's because what they're all about is being the mouthpiece and the policymakers for the ultra-rich. I mean, they're also kind of crazy, and great numbers of them are pretty intolerant about people that are different from them and what have you, and they maintain a lot of the old prejudices of anything from 20 years ago to 2,000 years ago.
Right.
But, and I'm always amazed that, an ordinary person would actually think that this is a party that could represent fairly, that's an important word, fairly the interests of most Americans. But you see it, and what's happened over the last 30 years is that what had occurred between the 1930s and 1980, when Ronald Reagan began the counter-revolution to the New Deal, was that the middle class is beginning to shrink, is that there's been no real advance in the average incomes. In fact, in many places they've gone down, whereas the rich have gotten richer. And literally the poor and the middle class have gotten poorer. And nowhere is it, I think, more illustrative than in New York City. Only 10 floors have been completed in what is intended to be the tallest residential building in the Western Hemisphere. a slender 84-story tower on Park Avenue at 56th Street in Manhattan. And so you're getting this? This is an 84-floor apartment, right?
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of it.
The top penthouse has already been bought for, you ready for this? $95 million.
Just a little chump change.
Little chump change, yeah. Other buyers have snapped up apartments in the lower floors for prices that are almost as breathtaking.
$40 million, $30
million. Yeah, and who's going to buy it? Russian metal barons, Latin American tycoons, Arab sheikhs, and Asian billionaires. Ultra-luxury housing and construction is booming across Manhattan, which is now beginning to rival London in popularity with the world's wealthy. The number of condominium buildings in the borough in Manhattan with apartments selling for more than $15 million has raised to 49 from 33 in 2009.
Damn.
The growth in high-end projects in Manhattan comes as housing for the working and middle class is increasingly in short supply in the city. So here's, it's available for the wealthy because they got it. These buildings are proving so profitable that they are warping the local real estate market, making it more difficult to put up more affordable housing. And Rafael Vignoli, the architect who designed this big tower, said there are only two markets, ultra-luxury and subsidized housing. Wow. So if you're just a middle-class person...
Sounds like America.
Yeah, you're screwed. The rush to build these towers underscores the gap between the rich and the poor in New York City, said James Parrott, chief economist for the Fiscal Policy Institute. He said the median family income in the city has fallen 8% since 2008. And you'd say, well, wait a minute, 2008, we're always saying, what happened in 2008? That's where Barack Obama was elected. But this isn't a result of his policies or Democratic Party policies. This is the realization of Reaganomics. Manhattan's super luxury condo boom, along with rocketing foreclosures in Queens and record homelessness, present an unconstructed view of accelerating polarization in this so-called recovery. Now think about this. I mean, all those words just kind of flow together. There's a super luxury condo boom along with rocketing foreclosures. Yeah. That's what's happening here in Detroit, too, in Queens. Record homelessness, and people are around that can spend $95 million on an apartment. Now, get this. Isaac Sinbahar, the developer of this, this is a different one, at 56 Leonard, a 60-story tower in Tribeca. It's an area where penthouses are going for a mere $20
million. quieter area.
Yeah, signed contracts with buyers for 70% of the 140 apartments in just 10 weeks. Determining who is buying many of these properties is a challenge. The super rich often go to great lengths to shield their identities, requiring confidential agreements with builders and brokers and using anonymous corporate entities for purposes. In an interview, the developer, 432 Park, Harry B. Macklow, said he and his partner, CIM Group, already had contracts for this apartment building for $1 billion worth of apartments, and total sales are expected to surpass $3 billion for a building that will cost about $1.25 billion to complete. The cheapest apartment in the building, 351-square-foot studio, cost $1,590,000.
350 square feet.
Yeah. Like small houses.
I thought my house was small.
What is yours? Like 1,000?
Like 1,200.
Is yours?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, a lot of around ours are.
I have a basement, so it's a little different than
they
yours.
They don't count the basements.
They don't?
No.
Well, I think it's still around 1,200.
I think yours is 1,000.
Okay. Fine.
I mean, I know the layout. I mean, it's very typical for that area and that type of house.
It's kind of like your house.
No, ours is 1,200. Ours is 13.5, actually.
Well,
we don't have a basement. So who's buying all this? Half the buyers are foreigners. And many of these buildings, only about a quarter of the units, will be occupied at any one time. Let me go by that again. These are going to be full occupancy. Half the buyers are foreigners. Many of these buildings, only about a quarter of these units, will be occupied at any one time. This is called a pied-à-terre. Pied-à-terre? This is a little country getaway. That's what it used to be. It's a French word. I'm probably mangling it. P-I-E-D-A. Like
pied-à-terre.
Pied-à-terre. Okay. Yeah, that's better.
Yeah.
Oh, did you take French in school?
I went to culinary school and learned classic French training. So
oui, oui.
A few words. Yeah. I've been to France.
pied de terre. So did I. I couldn't understand a word they said.
Yeah, I'll admit to struggling.
Yeah. Here they got this, as you said, this, not a photograph, but a drawing of what this big 80-story residential building that's going to be the largest in the Western Hemisphere. The first, the top six floors are used for mechanical equipment. The full floor penthouse apartment is going to be $95 million. The monthly common charge, $17,805. That's the monthly you got to pay.
You mean
the,
like your association fees?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's insane.
It's 8,255 square feet, has six bedrooms, seven baths, two half baths. But, you know, for the average person or the average millionaire, I guess, four-bedroom apartment, 5,400 square feet, four-bedroom, five baths, two half baths. The common monthly common charge is only $11,693.
Oh, that's way better.
Asking price, $45 million. Then it goes down, and finally you can get to two-bedroom apartment, 1,800 square feet, two bedrooms, two baths, $3,850. But I thought the most interesting
now
thing.
Now, that's more reasonable.
Yeah. But if you're that wealthy, you know, you're not exactly mowing the lawn. I guess they don't have lawns there. You're not doing much of the work yourself, so you have to have a staff. And they have studio apartments on the 28th and 29th floors that are available only as maid's quarters to residents already owning a large apartment. And these maid's quarters range from $1.5 million.
My gosh.
To $3.9
million. I might need a job.
Personal wine cellars are available, by the way.
Oh, beautiful.
If you don't have much of a collection, the wine cellar would be $158,000. If you got a lot of wine on hand, it's $378,000.
Yeah, I'd need that bigger one.
So, on one hand, and I know sometimes when we've said stuff like this, like, eat the rich!
Yeah.
That you just say, hey, it's their money, they earned it. Well, a lot of them didn't earn it, they inherited it and what have you. Somebody that has earned it, Howard Stern, is paying $52 million for a Palm Beach home.
Yes, he is.
But here's what's going on in New York City. So you have this situation where you have these millionaires and billionaires that are bidding up the cost of living even
yeah.
more so. But the rise in New York City's poverty rate as a result of the recession has apparently eased, according to this article, but not before pushing nearly half the city's population into the ranks of the poor or near poor in 2011. And this was according to analysis by the Bloomberg administration. This is the mayor's own administration,
yeah.
So he's not trying to hide anything. That year, in 2011, according to the city's measure, about 46% of New Yorkers were making less than 150% of the poverty threshold. I don't want to go into this whole thing. But they're finding it incredibly poor, harder and harder to live in New York City.
Yeah.
All right.
I know we have a phone call, but I want to say, if we don't get it tonight, Donald wrote in and wanted us to bring up the black mound of Canadian oil waste rising over Detroit. So we definitely need to talk about this because it involves those evil Koch brothers.
Well, wait a minute. You kind of gave it away because it's on the Detroit River in property owned by Matty Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge and is tried to scam all this stuff through. There's a three pile of petroleum coke, C-O-K-E, which is this byproduct of this tar sands oil drilling.
That we talk about.
And guess who owns it? The Koch brothers!
The Koch brothers. Yeah.
Although it's K-O-C-H. So the Canadians are looking at these huge piles. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com.
It says one covering an entire city block on the other side of the Detroit River.
And some of that stuff is blowing into the river and blowing into Windsor as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it on our Facebook page?
I haven't put it up yet, but I will.
Okay, we'll do that. All right, let's go to Chris in Dearborn Heights. Hey, Chris, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, what's up, Peter?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I got to say this. I understand you're very Democratic-leaning. How do you feel that Obama, knowing that the IRS is targeting Tea Party groups, will this be his Watergate?
No.
Nope.
And he didn't know that. I mean, the report, the what was it, the GAO, the General Accounting Officer, the Inspector General said that no one higher up knew it. You know, this is...
The Republican Party wishes this would
be. Yeah, I mean, this...
They're trying to find his Watergate.
For one thing, the Republicans knew about this in 2012. I don't know why they...
They're getting desperate now.
Yeah. Yeah, this is not Watergate. I mean, listen, the Nixon administration was this criminal administration that set these people off to breaking and entering, then did everything they could to subvert the nature of government. And this was wrong. The president said it was wrong. He fired the guy that was at the head of the department, even though he had nothing to do with it. In fact, the guy that was running the whole deal was a Bush appointee. I mean, why isn't Bush, why are you concerned about Obama? What about Bush? What about Rumsfeld? What about all those guys? These guys are war criminals.
Well, I completely agree.
Okay.
Oh, good.
All right, never mind.
I feel better.
Yeah.
However,
there's a however, Peter.
Go ahead.
The IRS appointee who was fired or recently discharged wasn't in charge when all this BS happened.
He's a scapegoat.
Yes.
Yeah, we agree.
So, do you feel this will become Obama's Watergate at all?
No.
I think that most people don't give two whatevers about it, and it will soon blow over. I don't think that most people even understand, and I'm not even sure I understand what the Republicans are about, on about, for instance, about Benghazi, and they're thinking this is going to bring Obama down, and it's going to stop Hillary from being the candidate and what have you. Well, that there was a lot more diplomats killed under Bush and lots more under Reagan. Reagan sat there and when, what was it, 360 Marines were killed in Beirut and didn't seem to do much to him, did it?
Well, I don't disagree with that. And quite frankly, why are we involved in those countries?
Thank you. Why? That's no one asked. Why is there a consulate in Benghazi, Libya? Why are we spending our money and putting our citizens at risk for what our interests, which are the oil interests?
And why are
right?
we everywhere? That's right.
Yeah, that's what our interest. It's not our interest. It's the interests of the oil companies.
Disagree fully. Petrodollars.
Petrodollars. Yeah, I haven't heard about that.
Petrodollars.
Haven't heard about that one in a long time. But yeah, that's about it. All right, we're almost out of time, so thank you very much. I appreciate your call. I was looking for something. I don't know if I can find this right away, but...
what is it?
About... I got too many.
I can help you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
Yeah, you can. All right. Let's just talk a little more about that black mound of Canadian oil waste is rising over Detroit. When you hear this interview, if you're up beginning at 1:30, which... please do, when we're talking with Doug Peacock, the author of In the Shadow of the Sabretooth. He's almost saying game over. And now we're at this point where we have 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. And they said if it goes over 350, it's going to be tough. We're over that now. And there has to be enormous changes made in what we burn. We can't keep subsidizing these oil companies. You know that we're subsidizing oil companies millions of dollars a day, the highest profitable corporations in the world, and taxpayers are giving them, we're giving them breaks, tax breaks,
yeah,
that you and I have to make up.
Meanwhile, people are bitching about all these quote-unquote entitlements.
Yeah, the big entitlements, of course, are, in fact, just that, the ones that...
To the oil companies.
Yeah. Oh, here it is. Yeah. We passed the 400 parts per million milestone as a result of the growth of the global CO2 emissions from the human-driven burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. The president and the White House are in part to blame. The president has spectacularly failed to forge bold policies to avert climate catastrophe. This is according to Michael Dorsey, a visiting scholar and professor of environmental policy at Wesleyan University's College of the Environment. So that's what I was saying earlier about Obama. He's failed to forge bold policies to avert climate catastrophe. Whoa, climate catastrophe? I mean, I don't think any of you can, and I'm not even sure 100% I can really believe it. You know, one of the things, and I'm trying to think whether my interview with Doug Peacock, did he talk about this on the air, or did we talk about it after? I should have talked about it on the air. That increasingly the equator and both sides of the equator is going to become unlivable. It's going to become too hot. It's going to become agriculture. It's going to be impossible. And a lot of these people are going to be heading north. I'm not talking about, you know, I mean, desperate to, for food, desperate, for, to get out of Sahara desert levels. So right now though, the administration and Congress, and this has been going on, Bush, and Obama, giving America's five oil companies more than $350 million per day, more than $14.5 million an hour in subsidies.
Yeah. It makes me sick. We got to get out of here.
With that good news,
we like to end on a happy note. A happy note, yeah.
Well, thank you, John Miller. Thank you for doing everything you do.
Here, there is a happy note.
Yeah. What? Oh, that.
We will be back next week.
Yeah. And also, I think what's happy about this coming interview is that people were fighting the big corporations and winning.
Go get them, Tigers.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. 101 WRIF.
Welcome to
everything that rocks.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff.
From that someone, and it's the other child. Let's get.
From the Riff, listen today at High Noon with Ann Carlini on 101 The Riff.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, there's an old adage that says you can't fight City Hall. And that really is an old adage. Probably the modern version of that is you can't fight corporations. You can't fight the federal government. Is that the individual citizen is just pretty much helpless and powerless in the face of this great concentration of power and of wealth and of political influence and all of that. But there is some good news out there. People are fighting back. People are saying, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. One of them is a group called the Detroit Eviction Defense. And in the studio with me is Steve Babson. He's a volunteer organizer with it. And we're going to talk to him about what's happening in the Detroit area, about foreclosures, the role of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and what's being done to confront the amazing amount of foreclosures and evictions. Steve Babson, in fact, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter. It was great to be here.
Well, you know, one of the things that occurred to me is, and I probably should know better, but exactly what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is. We know, well, you know, listen, I don't want to display my ignorance and say most of us know it and not be completely right. So, Steve Babson, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, what are they?
Well, let's start with Fannie Mae, and actually its formal name is Federal National Mortgage Association, FNMA, and that was its stock identification as well on Wall Street, and so people just used that acronym and they just turned it into Fannie Mae. That's how the nickname was generated. It's an old New Deal agency. It goes back to 1938, and it was for many, many decades a public agency that would buy mortgages from banks. And the virtue of doing so, it was argued, was that by replacing the bank's money immediately, the bank doesn't have to wait 30 years to recover the loan, and that means the bank can keep loaning money as it is replenished by Fannie Mae making that purchase of the mortgage and holding on to it.
That sounds like a great idea.
Not a bad idea. The problem is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac became, Freddie Mac came along later, by the way, and then both were privatized roughly around 1970. They became private profit-making corporations with a kind of implied backstop by the government. Because what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were doing was they were buying those mortgages, holding on to them, but often enough, and increasingly what they were doing, was bundling thousands of these mortgages together into something called a mortgage-backed security. And they would then sell that to Wall Street investors and banks that wanted to tap into this income stream from thousands and really millions of homeowners who were paying their mortgage to a bank that is servicing the mortgage but doesn't actually hold it anymore. The bank has sold the mortgage to Fannie Mae. It continues to collect your money as the servicing bank, but it sends it along to Fannie Mae. Fannie Mae either then deposits the money in its own account because it's holding on to the mortgage and that's how they were profitable, or Fannie Mae is then sending it along to the holders of these mortgage-backed securities that represent thousands of mortgages bundled together, and the income stream is then sluiced off into Wall Street investors and banks.
Well, it sounds like one of those deals that led to the great housing bubble and collapse.
Well, it did indeed. In fact, it's what led to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac teetering on the verge of bankruptcy and had to be taken over by the federal government in 2008. And the reason that happened was, is in order to sell these mortgage-backed securities to Wall Street, they had to reassure the investor that the thousands of mortgages in these bundles were good loans that were going to be paid off. And so Fannie Mae promised the investors that if any of those mortgages bundled into those mortgage-backed securities was to go into default, Fannie Mae would reimburse the investor for the full value of the outstanding loan. It was a guarantee, in other words. And the scale of this is pretty daunting. Right now, there are 48 million mortgages in the United States, and 29 million of them are owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So they own nearly two-thirds of all the residential mortgages in the United States, some of which were then bundled up, sold to Wall Street with the guarantee that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would reimburse them for the full value of any mortgage that went into default. And here's where it really got nuts, because they started buying up subprime mortgages and including those in the bundles that they were selling to investors. And as you know, and many of your listeners I'm sure can recall, it was the subprime mortgages with very few standards, with virtually no money paid down, with balloon payments that would sock the homeowner within 2 or 3 years. And in fact, many of the originators of these subprime mortgages knew that they were going to go bust, that the homeowner couldn't possibly afford the balloon payments once they came due. But the originators would sell the mortgage to the bank. The bank would sell the mortgage to Fannie Mae. Fannie Mae would sell the mortgage to the investor. It's like hot potato. They throw it along and hope it would blow up in someone else's hands. And when it did, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were stuck with the bill because they had promised to reimburse investors for all of these really lousy subprime mortgages that they included in their bundles of mortgages underlying the mortgage-backed security.
Now, Steve Babson, the name of your group is Detroit Eviction Defense. So we're talking about a process here in the Detroit area, particularly where homeowners are being thrown out of their house, foreclosure, and then eviction. They're suffering. What's happened to the people running Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that were responsible for this? There has to be penalties here for bad business decisions. And usually, if you're a small businessman, you make some errors, you're gone. Why is it that the homeowner is suffering the results of all this and not the people that ran Fannie Mae? Or is it so anonymous that there's no one to hold directly accountable for?
Well, no, there are. And those managers, many of them are gone. They are now replaced by a new group of federal administrators, some of whom were promoted from within Fannie Mae, including the current acting director, a guy named Edward DeMarco. And he's a very conservative man and acts basically on behalf of supporting the banking industry. That's what they're accustomed to. That's what their culture is. That's what they're about. And as you know, the whole bailout and all of the monies that were used to prop up the banks that were too big to fail, too big to go to jail, all of that money, roughly $600 billion in the Troubled Asset Relief Program and also the monies that were used to prop up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's obligations. And that's what happened. They had to pay off these investors who were holding on to these defaulting loans, and they didn't have the money to do it. They had never saved that money because they never believed the housing market would go bust. So who steps in to pay the bill? Taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
And about $185 billion have been used to pay off investors who were guaranteed that those mortgages would never go bust. Well, they did. And the current management of Fannie Mae basically operates on the presumption that the way to restore the economy is to lavish subsidies and incentives and bailouts on the banks, and then the banks will eventually do the right thing because they claim that's what the free market's all about. It's a delusional notion these days, as far as I'm concerned, but it's what they act on and what they're about. So they don't really care very much, unless it embarrasses them politically, that the result is that homeowners who have been defrauded, who have been the victims of predatory lending, who are then basically subject to the stonewalling of the servicing bank that doesn't really want to give them a mortgage modification. That costs money. A servicing bank that is obligated to at least pretend that it's engaging in this idea of giving people mortgage modifications to stay in their home, because there's a federal program that promotes mortgage modifications called HAMP.
And very few people are able to take advantage of it.
Right? Not as nearly as many as they had hoped. They thought 3 to 4 million homeowners would be helped by this home affordable modification program, HAMP. And it's actually less than a million, one quarter of what they projected. And part of the problem is that the banks that are servicing these mortgages for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would just as soon foreclose. It's actually cheaper and more profitable for them to foreclose. Left to their own devices, that's what they'd rather do.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, on the face of it, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense, but at some twisted Wall Street banking level, I guess it does.
Well, here's why.
Go ahead.
Because you have the old model in mind of the local bank loaning money to local customers in a local community where the bank would have some stake in maintaining that neighborhood, maintaining that community, because it's the source of their business revenue. But that's no longer the case. The banks now that run our economy are massive, multinational, global corporations, and they really have no skin in the game for any particular neighborhood. They don't really care what happens to your neighborhood. They move on to Sri Lanka or Alabama or wherever they're going to find the next revenue pile. And so they will trash an economy, trash a local city, without a second thought, really, because it doesn't necessarily harm their interests as a bank, as a global massive bank.
You're listening to Peter Werby Show. My guest is Steve Babson. He's an organizer with the Detroit Eviction Defense. And one of the things I want to do, and let's get this in a couple of times, when I was talking about fighting back, both in terms of direct action, which we'll get to in a little while, but there's also going to be a people's hearing, and this is going to be an opportunity for people to talk to representatives from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's coming up tomorrow, Monday, May 20th, pardon me, 4 to 6 p.m. at the UAW Local 600 Hall, and that's at Dixon, Wyoming, in Dearborn. But tell us about that. This is kind of extraordinary that a government agency would say, okay, we're going to sit down with a bunch of pretty angry homeowners and housing activists and listen to your complaints, because I don't think they think they're going to get any compliments.
Right. That'll be in a week, on May 20th, Monday, May 20th.
Well, this is airing. We are recording this now, so it actually is tomorrow.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's okay. We
all
don't...
right.
Go ahead.
The miracle of modern technology. Anyway, right. Here we are. So sorry for that. And what we're doing is we're going to have the opportunity to put in front of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac the evidence of how their policies on the ground are producing a disaster and augmenting what we're calling a hurricane without water. We argue that Detroit in particular, many other urban centers, but Detroit in particular, has been devastated by the economic and social disaster that has followed on the collapse of the housing industry. We were struck particularly hard here. We have the highest metro unemployment of any major urban area in the country. We have the highest foreclosure rate of some of the top cities that have been devastated by the subprime lending scandal. We had the highest default rate of subprime loans in the country. We have a foreclosure rate that's three times the national average. And many of you are familiar with the parts of Detroit that have been devastated by this economic hurricane without water. We're arguing that when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac implement a moratorium on foreclosures in those areas that were devastated by Hurricane Sandy, they were doing the right thing. They were trying to basically respond to a natural disaster. We're saying they should respond to the unnatural disaster caused by economic collapse and predatory lending. And Detroit is the leading ground zero for that devastation. And we want them to respond by declaring a moratorium on foreclosures here and then helping people stay in their homes by reducing mortgage principal for underwater loans, that is, loans where the value of the loan is now much higher than the plummeting value of the house. And for those kinds, and half, by the way, half of all homeowners in Detroit are underwater by mm-hmm. that definition. They owe more on their mortgage than the house is worth. And we're saying to keep people in their homes who have been beleaguered by unemployment, by high medical bills, by the death of a spouse, by divorce, whatever it is that impacts their income and puts them in hardship. We want Fannie Mae to declare a moratorium on foreclosures and to reduce mortgage principal to keep them in their homes. That's where that money should go. That's where the bailout money should go. It should go to direct assistance to people rather than delivering it to banks.
You can go to DetroitEvictionDefense.net. Information on this people's hearing. It's Monday, May 20th, 4 to 6 p.m. at the UAW Local 600 Hall in Dearborn. And it's also sponsored by the UAW and the Metro AFL-CIO. You talked about skin in the game. Why have these labor organizations signed on, do you think?
Well, I think they recognize that their role in the crisis economy that we are confronting here, they cannot define themselves in ways that narrow their role down to simply representing the workers who have a collective bargaining agreement. They seem more and more now to understand that what they have to be about is a working class movement that represents working people as a community on the job and off the job, that we're part of a social movement and not basically a narrowly defined collective bargaining agent simply for the members of that union. It has to be the labor movement, if it's going to survive, is trying to redefine itself as what it should have been all along and has been in past years and should be again, and that is a social movement representing working people on the job and off the job.
You know, Steve Babson, when you ask people where are they from, they say Detroit. They could live in St. Clair Shores or Dexter, Michigan or whatever. You live right in the city of Detroit. Your home, I assume, is not facing foreclosure. You've had a distinguished career as a professor at Wayne State University. And you, again, mentioned skin in the game. What's it all to you if people get their homes foreclosed?
Well, the argument we make, and it certainly applies to my own circumstance, my wife and I have been living in East English Village for the last 30 years, and our mortgage actually will be paid off this summer. But there's no way that you can escape the impact of this crisis, because what happens when a neighboring home goes empty? In Detroit, it's clearly going to bring down housing values, whether it's the suburbs or Detroit. And the more houses that go empty, the more all of us suffer a hit in terms of the plummeting value of our homes. It obviously contributes to the erosion of our tax base. And when the house is then stripped, or when a drug trade moves in, or a hooker trade, and that's happened in East English Village, but we've been very, I think I want to say on behalf of our neighborhood, we've been really very well organized in terms of cleaning that up and keeping as many of those kinds of problems at bay as possible. But it's hard. It's hard because this is really is a storm surge of foreclosures and disaster that's threatening all kinds of neighborhoods across the metropolitan area. And so I've had friends who have been on the verge of foreclosure in my neighborhood, and we rallied to their defense, and they're still in their home because we collectively responded and were able to successfully avoid the eviction and stop it.
Knowing you for a long time and also your wife, I know there's also an ethical component to this. It's not just practical and economic. I mean, you don't like to see people, to put it bluntly, getting screwed.
No, I don't. And I also think that a social movement that can, you know, aspire to changing the world and pushing us in a more positive direction has to begin with these local struggles. You got to dig where you stand, and it has to be about finding the ways in which you can oppose corporate greed, and the kind of massive robbery that goes on that is sanctioned by the system. Unfortunately, the courts are very slow to act on behalf of the interests of the majority of us. They tend to respond to the powerful institutions that exert their will through the political process. And so we pack the courtroom often enough when we're trying to send the message to the judge that this is not a helpless individual. We're talking about someone who has community support. We're going to rally to the defense of that home if they attempt to act on the eviction. We're going to picket the bank. We're going to lobby massively, not just individually. We will send delegations down to public officials and ask them to come down to the street and talk with us. And that kind of pressure makes a difference. That's what's actually kept a lot of people in their homes. Not enough. We're only winning skirmishes. We're still losing the war. But it is empowering, and if you have a feeling of the potential of a movement that brings together people in a unified way to defend working families and help them save their homes. And when it's successful and you turn back the dumpster and you prevent the eviction, it's really it's a powerful feeling. It's a powerful feeling that you can make a difference and actually act on behalf of a better world.
You can fight City Hall. You can fight the corporations. I want to get to some of the details of these Detroit eviction defense actions. But I just wanted you to address, it's got to be at least one cynic in among our listeners, hopefully only one, that says, hey, look, these people were offered a contract. They didn't read it well enough, or they should have known that they didn't have the capacity to meet the requirements. And it's a mean, cruel world, and ultimately it's their fault. And why should we prop up people that have made bad decisions?
Well, you could, I think, make that argument with respect to the banks. That's where I would start with that argument.
Okay.
With respect to individual homeowners, you have to think through what actually happened. And first of all, with subprime lending, the particular targeting that occurred is indicative of where the sort of moral center is when it comes to the mortgage origination industry. They would target elderly folks in particular, and elderly folks where they could take advantage of their kind of innocent trusting of a bank or of a mortgage banker. How could possibly someone dressed in that finest suit be engaged in a practice where they know that that individual will not be able to sustain that mortgage once the balloon payments and the other little trick bags start engaging? And that starts with that. It starts with the targeting of African-American neighborhoods, because often enough banks will not provide regular and sustainable financing for, they redline certain neighborhoods. And that means that they are required to turn to Countrywide and other kinds of mortgage originators that weren't banks and that were engaged in this predatory lending. And you may not have an option, therefore. That may be your only way of acquiring the capital to get a home. And then think through how many of these homeowners would rather be paying on their mortgage, would rather have a home that had a value that was even remotely close to the value of the mortgage, but were victimized by the crashing economy that was brought down by the misbehavior of the banks. It's their fraudulent behavior and misbehavior that accounts for the economic hole we fell into in 2008, 2009, and still are in this neighborhood. In Detroit, the unemployment rate officially is about 18%. This is Depression-era levels of unemployment.
And it's probably higher. During the 1930s, there were eviction defenses. In fact, whole neighborhoods would stop people from being thrown out of their apartments or their houses. Tell us, in fact, I see we're running out of time, and one of the things that you can do is go to DetroitEvictionDefense.net. It'll be all the information about what the group is doing, plus the people's hearing on Monday, May 20th at the UAW Local 600 Hall in Dearborn. But tell us just very briefly what kind of direct action occurred and what kind of impact it had.
Well, what we do is a homeowner who is facing eviction, and we often have people coming to us really as they're about to face the bailiff, and in the case of Detroit, where the dumpster will be put in front of the home. And the first thing we do is organize a sort of emergency legal triage where we file motions in court to try to stay the eviction order and then give us time to pressure the bank and Fannie Mae to do the right thing. Because our experience is that inevitably what we find is that the people about to be thrown out are people who, for example, just suffered a stroke or where a child is deadly ill and the medical costs have put people right over the top, and they no longer can support a mortgage that might have had balloon payments engineered into it in the first place. And so what we do is try to shame the bank and try to shame Fannie Mae, and we will picket the bank and basically send the message out that we are not going to permit the eviction of this family. And we will then organize a vigil in front of the house in anticipation of the possible arrival of the dumpster. In the case of Detroit. And on several occasions, we've actually blocked the dumpster. Or if the dumpster was already there, we filled it with leaf bags so that they could not use it to pull the furniture out of these people's homes. And so far, we've been very successful because so far, we've been basically able to show that people are being victimized here and they should have gotten a mortgage modification. The servicing bank should have acted on behalf of keeping in their homes. That's what they got the bailout for. That's what they get these incentives for. But it's expensive to do modifications for the bank. They don't want to renegotiate case by case. That means a fixed cost. They'd have to hire people and train them. They'd rather not do that or only do it up to a certain limited point. So some people get modifications, but 3 out of 4 who apply do not. And they are then at risk of losing their home. And we say that's wrong. And the way we fight it is by kicking up as much dust as we can.
We've got about 2 minutes left, Steve Babson, and I want to again announce the hearing that's going to happen tomorrow, Monday, May 20th, 4 to 6 p.m. at the UAW Local 600 Hall, Dix Avenue at Wyoming. If your house is facing foreclosure, not just in the city of Detroit, but anywhere that you're hearing my voice, although I know part of it you're hearing it worldwide. But the idea is to tell the feds to stop the foreclosures by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And we just have about a minute or so left. Who is these agencies going to send? And like I said earlier, they're not going to be faced with a very happy public.
No, they're not. But we're going to have, we've organized a format where people are going to be able to give, you know, a concise and clear view of what's actually happening on the ground. We hope to have several hundred people in that room. We're going to have, by the way, a legal clinic operating at the same time. So if people have individual issues and they want to talk confidentially to one of the lawyers who has been helping us, they should bring their issues to that event as well. We're also going to be organizing for future actions to support of homeowners in the area who are at risk of losing their homes. We've got several campaigns that we're working on, and we'll be alerting people to the next steps that we'll be taking in that regard. So it'll be kind of an organizing meeting at the same time that in the main room there's going to be this hearing where we'll have a chance to document and articulate what our alternative is. And our alternative is stop the foreclosures, declare a moratorium, we're a hurricane without water, and reduce mortgage principal to keep people in their homes.
All right, we just have 30 seconds. What would solve the problem? You say tell the feds to stop the foreclosures. Would this just be a policy decision by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or does it need a congressional statute or what?
They can make that decision. They did it in the case of Sandy, and we're saying they should do it here. This is an emergency situation. We need triage here in Detroit. We do not need more foreclosures that simply aggravate our problems and make them all the worse.
Well, Steve Babson, thank you so much. Steve Babson is an organizer for the Detroit Eviction Defense, and you go to their website, DetroitEvictionDefense.net, And also, you can participate, whether your home is underwater, whether you're facing foreclosure or not, but particularly if you are. It's a people's hearing, Monday, May 20th, 4 to 6 p.m. It's tomorrow. UAW Local 600 Hall in Dearborn is the place, Dix Avenue at Wyoming. And the idea is to tell the feds to stop the foreclosures in the Detroit area. Steve Babson, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
101 WRIF.
That's perfect.
Everything that rocks.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
Everything That Rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, I really like it when I'm going to interview an author who's written a book where the subject matter is so important that that what it talks about really has this direct effect, not just on our recent history, but perhaps our history going back millennia, many millennia, if you will, and that the author is such a fascinating guy that I hardly know how to do the introduction. You know, I usually give this little spiel before I introduce someone, but I'm just going to bring him right on. His name is Doug Peacock. And he's identified in the literature that I get as a writer, a renegade naturalist. I want to get at that. An adventurer. His name is Doug Peacock. He spent the last 50 years wandering the Earth's wildest places and studying grizzly bears and advocating for the preservation of wilderness. He's a Vietnam veteran. He was actually a former Green Beret medic, and he was a close friend of the author Edward Abbey. And he is the real-life model, if anybody has read The Monkey Wrench Gang, for Abby's character, George Washington Hayduke. This is actually a must-read book, and it's a novel. Very, very exciting. He's the author of Grizzly Years, Baja, and Walking It Off, A Veteran's Chronicle of War and Wilderness. His latest book, co-written with his wife, Andrea Peacock, is The Essential Grizzly, The Mingled Fates of Men and Bears. He was named a 2007 Guggenheim Fellow and a 2011 Lennon Fellow as well. It's a pleasure to welcome Doug Peacock. And, Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter.
One thing I forgot. Where are you on planet Earth? I forgot even to ask you that.
You know, I'm about 30 miles north of Yellowstone Park, and I was just up yesterday, and I saw a whole bunch of grizzly bear tracks. So if you like grizzly bears, come out and visit me.
I stay away from grizzly bears. Hey, but you actually were born, went to school not too far from where we are here in Detroit. Where you were born in Adrian, Michigan?
Actually, it's Elma, but, you know, I was a Michigan boy, and, you know, the seeds of this book, In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, you know, it has its roots in archaeology, and, you know, I lived, my dad was a Boy Scout guy, so I lived all around the Lower Peninsula, you know, in Clare and Cadillac, and I went to high school in Saginaw, but that's what got me started, you know, finding arrowheads in the muddy furrows of fields around Saginaw, Michigan when I was about 9 years old. And, and then going up to Mount Pleasant where there was a Boy Scout camp, and they found a mast down up there that was hunted by these people they called Clovis. And that was, it's one of the three mastodon kill sites in the United States, and all those prehistoric beasts and muddy fields and sandy ridges with arrowheads on them. I mean, that's really triggered my interest in a much wider, wilder world. I mean, eventually it propelled me into, you know, the empty spots on the, at the edges of the earth.
Well, you know, Doug Peacock, I'm sorry, it spoke great over you. Doug Peacock, this actually, this book has kind of spun my head to the point where I didn't even, as you indicated, didn't even give the title of the book. It's In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, a renegade naturalist considers global warming the first Americans who were the Clovis and the terrible beast of the Pleistocene. Let's just get some definitions out of the way. Why are you a renegade naturalist just as opposed to a regular naturalist?
Well, you know, I'm not very reverent, and I have a sort of a skeptical attitude towards authority of all kinds, and archaeology in particular, and it's also in the tradition of my old writer mentor, Edward Abbey. I would probably never let a bunch of unimportant facts get in the way of a good story.
There you go.
However, this book is... unlike my other books, which were memoirs, you know, and if you write a memoir, you can't tell whoppers, but you can tell little lies. In a book like this, it took me 5 years of really careful research, and there's a lot of facts in it. That's why it took so long to write.
Well, you were a Green Beret combat medic during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And that had this signal event in your life How did you get in the Green Berets? I mean, you were in there at a period when there was great anti-war fervor. You went there.
Yeah, and I was a part of that. I was a student activist, you know, at the University of Michigan. You know, I ran a speaker program. I invited Martin Luther King to come and speak at the University of Michigan. I invited Norman Thomas. You know, I was an anti-war or civil rights guy, and... you know, I didn't know much about Vietnam, but the war was just building up in Laos, and it's not a simple explanation, but it's sort of a perversion of my life that if I care about something, I have to go see for myself. And so this guy who was, you know, an anti-war student at the University of Michigan ended up a Green Beret medic, combat medic in the highlands of what used to be the northern part of South Vietnam.
What did your friends say? Here, you were an anti-war activist?
You know, they never mentioned it. You know, the guys I went to school with, I was the only guy that went into the military, that went to war. And they, you know, Vietnam never touched their lives. You know, they're doctors and lawyers and, you know, basically good guys, but you know they never paid any attention to it.
So you saw
no one ever. You know, I got together with my old college friends about 30 years after the war, and on Veterans Day, nobody brought it up.
Hmm. Now you saw this slaughter not only, I mean, literally firsthand. You were a combat medic, Green Berets, and so you saw it all. And then what happened after?
What happened after is, you know, I also, as a combat medic, but I mean, as a Green Beret medic, you're the closest thing to a doctor that, you know, you live in little isolated little A camps and villages in the middle of nowhere, and you're the closest thing to a doctor a couple thousand people are ever going to see. And when things come through, like the Tet Offensive, with all the bomb on both sides, you know, you're the guy that gets to handle the 179 civilian casualties that the war produced, mostly from our gunships, you know, but also from the NVA and the Viet Cong, who are hurting these same people across the river. And I pieced little bodies together for 5 days, and I realized that I had to get the hell out of there. So on March 16th, 1968, I was ordered out of the field because I was no longer an American over there. And I flew out, and on the way, you know, back to catch an airplane to come back to the States, we flew along the coast. Somebody shot at us. Not a big deal. And I looked down and noted the place. It was My Lai, and I flew over My Lai as it was happening. I didn't know that until a year later when I saw the pictures in Life magazine. Those pictures changed my life.
Where there was great civilian slaughter at the hands of an American unit.
Yeah, I was at My Lai Veterans Day a year and a half ago.
But so how did this affect you? Here you're a guy from Michigan, and then you wind up in the wilderness tracking bears. What is there a connection?
Well, it was the one place I've always been comfortable is in the woods, in the wild. And, you know, I thank Michigan for that. I thank my dad, who was a Boy Scout organizer. And when I came back from the war, like a lot of other vets, I was really out of sorts.
couldn't talk to people. So I went to one place I was comfortable, and I had discovered the Rocky Mountains by then. I basically just crawled back in the, into the bush like a wounded animal and camped out for 15 years. And in the course of that, you know, I camped out in Wind River and Yellowstone Glacier, and I ran into grizzly bears. And the grizzlies really, you know, I wasn't looking for them, but I sure as hell found them. And, you know, they ultimately saved my life because, you know, you can't really be self-indulgent hanging out with grizzly bears, you know. It's just utterly impossible. And, you know, the attitude they foster the most, it's just an attitude of humility. And that's exactly what I needed. You know, humility is also the emotional posture behind reason. And, you know, I've been fighting to protect them in wilderness ever since. And part of that war to value wilderness and protect the wild and the planet is the writing of this book, you know, In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, because the, you know, the bedrock argument, it's about global warming. And you know, I felt I should write about global warming. And unless you deny modern-day global warming altogether, it is the darkest bummer story in the world. And I didn't want to write a bummer book. So I took a step back, realizing that Homo sapiens, you know, our species, has undergone a global warming period before, you know. And it was right here in North America 15,000 years ago. And by writing about that, which is a story of adventure and these, you know, wonderful, terrible, dangerous beasts of the Pleistocene, the mammoth and the short-faced bear and the saber-toothed tiger, you know, in telling that story, there are useful parallelisms, you know. It's more allegory than analogy, but I was able to talk about our own time while telling a really exciting and maybe the greatest adventure story, you know, in the world, in
my opinion. The whole name of the book is In the Shadow of the Sabretooth, a renegade naturalist considers global warming the first Americans and a terrible beast of the Pleistocene. It's published by AK Press, a publisher I would highly recommend. It's akpress.org. Doug's website is dougpeacock.net. There'll also be a link at my website, peterwerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. You talk about the first Americans and mention the Clovis people, C-L-O-V-I-S. Now, those are not your and my ancestors, right? Ours come from Europe.
Exactly.
Tell us where, I mean, are these the Clovis, the people that came, like, across the land bridge from Asia?
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, there are also points of contention. So, you know, my basic conclusions are mine, and it's a wonderful field because there's so little hard science. You know, there's very little archaeology and paleontology to tell us what life was like 15 to 13,000 years ago. But the Clovis are the lower states, you know, where we live, the lower 48 were virtually unoccupied by people maybe 15,000 years ago. And then there's some evidence of just scattered people, little tiny sites with little tiny toolkits, but not very many of them. And maybe they never survived or persisted. And I think the exact reason they didn't persist is because the short-faced bear was here, this gigantic bear with long legs. The biggest specimens are 7 foot at the hip.
You
know, that's twice as big as the biggest grizzly bear. And this animal, you know, was partly a predator, but mostly a scavenger. And I don't think people, and the first people to the Americas were big game hunters. They couldn't protect their kills from this, you know, from this fast and fierce animal. And you don't see anybody pretty much until 13,000 years ago. And these are the Clovis people. These are the mammoth hunters. These are the guys that had this great big beautiful, you know, spear point that's so distinctive with a groove in it. And it's so beautiful it goes beyond function. Some people think it was, you know, a talismanic object to be exchanged in religious ceremonies. But anyway, the appearance of these people is the Clovis people, who are really the first Americans of any impact. You know, it's the first, you know, the Clovis people, you know, outshadow any other presence of humans by light years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two things that are unique worldwide about the Clovis people. Is first of all, the first Americans entered a continent, and this continent was four times of the wilderness without a footprint of an upright human being. It had never seen a human being before. And it was, you know, four times the size of Australia. And not a smoke on the horizon, not a track. So the continents, the Americas, were unoccupied. And then secondly, they were occupied by these, incredible, huge beasts of the Pleistocene. You know, there was a huge lion that was twice as big as an African lion, a huge American cheetah, there was saber-tooths, mammoths, mastodons, giant sloths weighing 6,000 pounds, and, you know, they entered such a place. Well,
they found remains of these animals.
Yeah,
right? Yeah.
And you know, there's some shadowy people. They just call them pre-Clovis that maybe never survived at all. But anyway, when Clovis show up, they have to. It appears that Clovis had to wait for the glaciers to melt. You know. The peak of the American glaciation was about 19,000-20,000 years ago, and then 15,000 years ago, and that's a period I write about, was a global warming period, and slowly the glaciers melted back, and a corridor opened up between the two huge ice sheets in North America, and that corridor was maybe available 13,000 years ago, a little earlier than that. And it appears the Clovis came all the way down from Alaska someplace. There were no mammoths up there, but, you know, once they got down to Alberta, they ran into mammoths. And somewhere they found great big flint quarries like you have in Michigan, too. And they invented this iconic Clovis Point, which was so big. You know, it was when you look at one of these things, you never think of rabbits and gophers and even bison. You know, you think of elephants. And within 200 years, the Clovis people had penetrated North America from Florida to Maine to Panama to Washington State.
Well, in fact, they got their name, right, because of these archaeological sites at Clovis,
right.
New Mexico.
Exactly. That's
yeah.
When the first mammoth in association with Clovis Point happened way back in the 30s. And, then, you know, and even before radiocarbon dating, archaeologists knew that, you know, there was somebody there hunting mammoths, and they knew that these things were really old. But, you know, the Clovis, it's a speed of the colonization that's unprecedented in world archaeological history. And the Clovis people didn't last that long.
Well, it must have been those winter months, huh? I mean, that they multiplied so much. Anyway, sorry, go ahead. Hey, Doug Peacock's my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and we're talking about the Clovis people, something that Doug treats in the shadow of the saber tooth. A renegade naturalist considers global warming, the first Americans who are the Clovis, and the terrible beast of the Pleistocene. It's published by AK Press. You can go to DougPeacock.net, and I'll have a link on my website as well. So, you know, there's some talk that, you know, when people tend to idealize pre-modern people, that they just hunted all these big animals, the megafauna, as they're called, into extinction. Where'd these bad boys go?
Well, the paleo-extinction, as they call it, which is it's the great Pleistocene extinction, and the megafauna disappears, and megafauna just means big animals, usually animals 200 pounds or more, and, you know, most of them disappear in just in a second of geologic time, you know, about 12,000 years ago, and the Clovis people are implicated because, you know, we know from scattered kill sites that they hunted the mastodon, they hunted mammoth, I think, whenever they could get a hold of them. However, the Clovis wouldn't have gotten down here without global warming. And global warming had already had its effect on moving the great, you know, the herbivores, the you know, the horses and the camels and the mammoths of the place they need. It had moved them around, and there's some evidence that they were on the decline at this time. And but the one and when they disappear, Clovis and all of these animals disappear like in a 10-year period. It's unbelievable.
Oh,
you know, they're
the
fossil record is still coming in, but it just narrows the time that these animals went extinct into this little window when it was really warming up fast and when Clovis people were on the scene. So the one unmistakable lesson of this, and it's our first example as, you know, as a modern human beings, is that climate change combined with human activity is just a deadly formula for extinction. And that's what, you know, the book is about, and it brings us right to our own doorstep today.
Of course, there's a few more people on the planet as well. That,
you're right. Yeah. You know, 7 billion people is not the same as Clovis times. You know, the early people, prehistoric people, were able to survive by making bold migrations that would be impossible in today's, you know, crowded world.
Hmm. Well, you said that in your opening remarks that in the shadow of the saber tooth, when we look at global warming today, it could be a pretty depressing story. But you were saying that that perhaps these pre-modern people, the Clovis, there's lessons there. But tell us. I'm not quite sure on the face of it that what it would be.
The lesson for me is the most important thing. Global warming is way ahead of us. You know, that our scientists are always underestimating the speed and severity of climate change. I mean, it's a catastrophe that I don't even tell high school students about. And, you know, our options are going to be few because, you know, climate change will eventually trigger war and starvation on a level that makes today's armed strife look like ping pong games. And, you know, what are people going to do? They're going to move around a lot. And, agriculture could be totally baked out of northern Africa, all of Asia, and where are those starving people going to go? Well, they're going to go north to the gulags of Siberia and industrial farming in Russia. There's going to be wars. You know, the hardest of our thinkers, people like James Lovelock, really think we're going to lose our civilization. I mean, it's going to be such a breakdown of society. You know, look, this is sort of a bummer story, and I'm summarizing, you know, the extreme position. But if that happens without civilization, what are we left with to work with? And I in this book, I say, you know, the best thing a guy like me can do is what he's been doing all along: fight to preserve wilderness. And not, you know, wilderness is not an idle place. It is the place we evolved as human beings. That's where the human mind evolved, and that's where our intellect evolved, and all our humanity. And, you know, we're going to need a place to go back and maybe start again. Who knows?
But, well, everybody is an environmentalist. I mean, even the first President George Bush was. But the environment continues to erode. More species going extinct, more forests being cut. Our habitat is disappearing, even if there wasn't global warming, let alone adding that. It is pretty dismal prospect, and I don't think people are too willing to face it. It seems like an intractable problem.
No, and it, you know, In the Shadow of the Sabretooth is really a book about the perception of peril. I mean, I think modern human beings simply do not recognize what is in their best interest for long-term survival. I mean, a child in danger, a dark alley, those things, you know, those things trigger an appropriate response from us, you know. And so we evolved to see the saber-toothed tiger in the bush. You know, we didn't evolve to see the consequences of, you know, 3 billion incrementally starving strangers thousands of miles away. And, somehow I think that perception of risk and peril needs to be refined, and I'm just hoping by talking about our evolution and our time on Earth with, you know, these incredibly fierce predators, there's some residual lessons lying along the trail.
Well, there's only 60 seconds left, and this is a mouthful, and I don't know what I would say if you asked me this, because I agree completely with you, Doug Peacock, and what you say in The Shadow of the Sabretooth about the need to preserve wilderness. But what do we do tomorrow? I mean, you're so far away from the center of American politics, Washington, yeah, D.C.
What we do tomorrow is do everything Bill McKibben tells you to do.
Bill McKibben, right?
By backing off, living smaller. I think it's really late in the game for these changes, but nonetheless, you know, we'll have to do our best. And I think we need to prepare, for sweeping change that we really can't imagine yet. And these are going to be tough times ahead. And it's going to stress, I think, our humanity more than anything has in the past, because, we can have all the social justice on Earth, which I've fought all my life for, and not have a planet on which to practice it.
Well,
that is my fear. We need to see the beast of our time is climate change. That's the saber tooth in the bush. We just need to look at it.
Well, it's always good if someone would say, in fact, gee, I see we're right out of time. If we could just say, hey, write your congressman. Well, it's going to take more than that. A first thing.
No,
to,
it's quite like hell. Get out there.
First thing to do is get together with your neighbors. And that's the main thing. And read books like this. It's In the Shadow of the Sabretooth. A renegade naturalist considers global warming, the first Americans, and the terrible beast of the Pleistocene. And this is a book that relates to today. My guest has been Doug Peacock. You can go to his website, dougpeacock.net. It's published by AK Press. They're akpress.org, and you can always link to all of it on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Doug Peacock, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Peter, what a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. 101 WRIF. Riff. 101 WRIF.
We take this to the next level. Oh, yeah.
The Riff.
excuse. I've got this time on my hands. You are the one to watch. Yes, I finally found the reason. I won't need an excuse. I've got this time on my hands. You are the one to watch. Yes, I finally found the reason. I won't need an excuse. I've got this time.
WRIF.com lets your voice be heard. Brought to you by Lady Jane's Haircuts for Men. New location opening May 28th on Grand River south of I-96 in the Brighton Mall. Haircuts just $10. Hear it, rate it at WRIF.com. More Riff Rock now. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.